from a member of his own party, a Labour member of the House of Lords. And Nigel Farage receiving, you might want to sit down for this, £5 million in an undisclosed personal donation from a cryptocurrency billionaire. Set to become even richer if Farage follows through on his policy pledges regarding cryptocurrency.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, senior figures from police and culture and business are meeting in Downing Street this morning to discuss efforts to tackle anti-Semitism. Sir Keir Starmer is renewing his call for the whole of society to stand with Jewish communities following recent attacks. Last week, two Jewish men were stabbed in Golders Green in North London. LBC's reporter Fraser Knight has more details from Downing Street.
Keir Starmer will say that the attacks on British Jews are a crisis for all of us and a test of our values as he pushes for action to tackle anti-Semitism at its root. Leaders from business, health and education sectors will all be here to meet with him this morning. Fraser Knight, LBC, Downing Street.
Iran's foreign minister says America risks being dragged back into a quagmire with its latest plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump's so-called Operation Freedom aims to ensure commercial ships can use the vital oil route. The US president has also warned that any attacks on US ships will result in Iran being blown off the face of the earth. A man who was shot at a barbecue in Brixton in South London over the bank holiday weekend has died. 25-year-old Keanu Taylor was one of four people injured when shots were fired from a vehicle in the early hours of Saturday. No arrests have been made. 149 people are still stranded on a cruise ship in the Atlantic Ocean, which has been hit by a rare rat-borne virus. Three people have died following the outbreak of hantavirus on the vessel, which was sailing from Argentina to Cape Verde. And online safety campaigners have told LBC that they're concerned ministers are dragging their feet over new safeguards. The government is currently consulting on an Australian-style social media ban for under-16s, along with other measures. Speaking to LBC this morning, campaigner Lauren Cowell accused the government of waffling on the issue.
Why are we waiting any longer? We have all of the evidence. We have enough evidence. We've got bereaved, over 27 bereaved families in this country alone who have suffered the ultimate consequences and devastation of what can happen with the what we know online. And so with that, with all the health professionals and the frontline medical professionals who are doing research every day in this topic, why are we waiting?
Ministers say they're committed to new restrictions but must make sure they work before bringing in any changes. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 80 points at 10,283. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 15. LBC weather, sunshine and showers for large parts of the UK. Some wintry downpours possible on higher ground for northern Scotland. A warm day for most, a high of 18 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
At Aldi, we think low prices are for everyone. And boy, do we mean everyone. You... Your nan, your cockapoo, your ex-situationship, Barbara from next door, traffic wardens, Piers Morgan, even that annoying guy James from finance. Yep, low prices should be enjoyed by all, not just those with a membership, what's it? So Aldi don't do one. No points, no cards, no faff. Aldi, which cheapest supermarket, even without a loyalty thingy?
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after ten, and you can tell I had a good weekend. I hope you did as well, by the way. Long weekend indeed, because I found myself sort of tilting at a windmill this morning that might sometimes seem a little bit too big or too fanciful. I am a member of the British media. I don't think that needed a spoiler alert or will come as a major shock to anybody. I am currently talking to you from behind a microphone in a studio and presenting what I think is the most popular speech-based programme on commercial radio in the United Kingdom. So I'm not just a member of the British media, I am a relatively... what would the word be? Prominent player in some ways, according to whichever measures you prefer. That's not a boast. That's not an opinion. Altogether now, that's counting. But there are days when I find myself contemplating current affairs, which is, after all, the meat and drink of what we do together every morning and what I get paid to pontificate upon. I find myself contemplating current affairs and wondering whether I am part of some Truman Show-style social experiment. It doesn't happen very often, and I'm conscious of the role that biases play from both ends of the telescope. I have biases. I have prejudices. I'm certain of it. I hope I don't have bigotries, but it's perfectly possible. And that doesn't exclude or preclude me from pointing out the hideous bigotries and biases elsewhere in our world, in our politics, and in our media. But there is only so far a bias can go. Right? That there is only so far a bias can go. And it's not enough some mornings to simply say, well, that's the way it goes. That's the way that bias has taken us. Because sometimes you look at a story or a juxtaposition of stories, a combination of stories, a coverage, and you just wonder whether you are actually part of something truly hideous. And listen, while I'm running through my CV, I don't just present a radio program. I've also written a book which essentially examines how on earth you create an ecosystem in which a population can be persuaded to vote epically and repeatedly against its own interests. It's called How They Broke Britain, and it's probably due a sequel. So I'm not ignorant of the forces that could be loosely described as oligarch media or vested interests or, violently effective lobby groups pretending to be think tanks while refusing to reveal where all that money is coming from. But even that, I mean, I suppose what I'm very cautiously suggesting to you is I'm more qualified than the average bear to answer the question that I'm about to ask you, but there are days when I can't answer it. There are days when my answers don't seem to be adequate. They don't seem to go far enough. In May of 2023, Keir Starmer received some spectacles, at quite expensive designer glasses, to the tune of £2,485 from a colleague who happens to be a very rich member of the House of Lords. His wife also got some free clothes. This in preparation for the imminent election campaigns. And we joined in the criticism of this. Although I hope, and I perish the days when the internet started doing viral clips, because if I did get a bit hysterical about it, you're going to be able to remind me in a moment. In May of 2024, forgive me, he received these glasses before becoming Prime Minister. And the world, I think you will remember, went a little bit mad, didn't it? The world went a little bit mad. The outrage, the fury with which this revelation was greeted by, I would like to say some, but I'm going to say almost all quarters of the British media. You can pick your favourite. If you want, you can think of somebody now who went absolutely bonkers about Keir Starmer getting some spectacles, getting gifted some spectacles by a parliamentary colleague who happened to be much richer than him. And you can probably measure on a scale of 1 to 10 how absolutely bonkers these people went. I turn your attention next to a story that I hope you're aware of, but which, if you're not, I get it. I completely understand how you have managed not to be aware of the following story. Nigel Farage, the leader of Reform UK, was given £5 million. £5 million, not his party, not his organisation, not his structure, not his last party or the one before that, but him. Current account territory. A £5 million personal gift. And he was given it, The Guardian reported last week, shortly before announcing that he would stand in the 2024 British general election after all, having previously insisted that he wouldn't. What's going on? a genuine question. What is actually going on? The man that gave him this donation, this personal donation of £5 million, this, who shall I make the cheque payable to, Nigel, donation of £5 million, is a so-called crypto billionaire who is based in Thailand and operates under two names. His given name was Christopher Harborne, but he has a Thai name as well in order to conduct his business in Thailand. And he is heavily invested in cryptocurrency, which Nigel Farage has subsequently revealed he intends to deregulate in the event of him becoming Prime Minister in ways that would, and I don't think you need to be an economist to answer this question or to make this point, which would be incredibly beneficial for people who have made a ton of money already out of cryptocurrency. Tons more money will be heading their way. £5 million versus three pairs of spectacles. Now, you know, and I know, that we live in a country, we live in a society where the traditional means of getting our hands on the news are changing and crumbling all the time. For example, newspapers. See, certainly the printed version of newspapers carry nothing like the weight that they used to carry. Tragically, the way that social media is engineered and algorithmed these days mean that you can actually control the diet of news that British people are receiving in the hope of advancing your own interests, whether financial or ideological. It is, lest there be any doubt, why Elon Musk bought Twitter. There's an extraordinary story in the news today about one of the vilest Islamophobic accounts on that platform being run by somebody who would be a target of the hatred that he disseminates were it not for the fact that he does it anonymously and is based in Pakistan. He runs an account on Facebook and Instagram, not Twitter, forgive me, publishing memes calling for all Muslims to be deported from Britain, and he's got 192,000 followers on Facebook. So that's how it works. That's how people get their information these days. So it's possible you missed this story. I will tell you again. £5 million as a private donation to a politician who at the time, I think, was chairman of the party and had said he wasn't going to run again because he was too skint. And then lo and behold, he announces that he's going to run again. And shortly after that, announces proposals that would render cryptocurrency billionaires eye-wateringly richer than they are already. And I don't need AI, although, Nico, thank you for actually taking up my offer, if you've got the time. I don't know if it's worth it. We could probably do it, couldn't we, off the top of our own heads and get it right. But make a list. Name a commentator. Name a broadcaster. Name a columnist. Name a commentator. And get some scales, and on one side of the scales, I want you to put the coverage that they gave to Keir Starmer's spectacles, and on the other side of the scales, I want you to put the coverage that they gave to Nigel Farage accepting £5 million privately, secretly, undisclosed from a cryptocurrency billionaire based in Thailand. Because I don't get this bit. I do not understand how 6 days after that story broke, it's almost entirely disappeared. Farage gave up his regular seat on Laura Koonsberg's programme, probably because even she, in these circumstances, would have been compelled to ask him questions about it. But I don't understand how people who do what I do for a living, I don't understand how people who call themselves commentators or columnists, I genuinely don't understand. I'm not a naive man. I'm a bit idealistic. I'm a little bit a sweet summer child at times. Of course I am. I would much rather live my life believing the best of people than the worst. But I do not understand my own industry. And it's on days like that that I despair. Because, look, either I'm completely in the wrong on this, or everybody else's. With a few exceptions, obviously, and most obviously, The Guardian, who broke this story and would probably have expected, I don't know if they're as naive as I am, they would probably have expected it to have dominated the news agenda for at least as long as Keir Starmer spectacles. Because just think for a moment about how mad that is. Just think how mad that is. It's not a donation. It's a gift. It's a present. How mad is that? We could sit here and express similar levels of incredulity if it received the same levels of attention that Keir Starmer's spectacles received. The same levels. So we'd sit here now and we would go, well, I mean, that's a bit rum, isn't it? Keir Starmer accepted some spectacles from a parliamentary colleague. Nigel Farage accepted a £5 million secret donation from a cryptocurrency billionaire based in Thailand who operates under two different names. And, God, what a weird country we live in that they've received equal and opposite amounts of coverage. Ha! Silly old me, I'd have thought the £5 million secret gift might have been a slightly bigger story or a slightly bigger deal than the spectacles. The spectacles. And a suit. But we're not. That's not the conversation we're having. We're not sitting here saying, good Lord, how did those two stories, despite being so obviously and violently different, receive the same level of coverage? We are sitting here and saying, why has one of them barely been mentioned by individuals and outlets who were obsessed, I think, for weeks with Keir Starmer's spectacles, but have had absolutely nothing to say about a prominent British politician taking a secret £5 million gift from a cryptocurrency billionaire shortly before, A, reverse ferreting on his pledge to stay out of politics, and B, announcing potential policies that would be of enormous, almost immeasurable financial benefit to cryptocurrency billionaires. This chap Harborne, by the way, is already the gifter of the largest ever single donation by a living person to a British political party. He gave £12 million to Farage's outfit in 2025, including a one-off gift donation of £9 million. £9 million. I haven't checked what Nigel Farage has to say on the subject, but he probably claims he's never met the bloke. Such is his want. Such is his style. £5 million in your current account, £12 million in your company account or your party account. And how much do you know about this dude? How much do you know about him? So, I've written a book about it. I've talked to you about it endlessly. I am a victim of the, what's the word that I want? A victim of the ecosystem I described, because that's why I mentioned to you a few minutes ago that I can only find myself with the appetite to do this sort of thing when I've had a particularly restful weekend. Because it's lonely work. Don't get your violins out, seriously, but it's lonely work. My father was a newspaper journalist, my late father. It's all I ever wanted to be. And until leaving newspapers, I was a fully paid-up member of the Defenders Till I Die Brigade. You know, even when I think Max Mosley was pursuing tabloid newspapers for extraordinary invasions of his privacy, I was attacking Max Mosley. I think I did so on Question Time. I was a member of the tribe. I was a member of the cult. I was absolutely, it's my family, it's my business, over the years of doing this job, with your help, I've come to see just how absolutely bent everything is. But every now and then, I sit here and I go, maybe I'm mad. And actually, this isn't extraordinary. Maybe I'm mad and this isn't insane. And this is one of those days. Could you tell me why you think this happens? That's all. And I would quite like sensible answers. I don't want you to hold back on the grounds that it might be obvious, because when something is as enormous and as egregious as this, every little helps, doesn't it? I don't want insensible answers necessarily, but I will tolerate a couple of unsensible ones. But what? How can we? Just tell me how we can live currently in a country where one party leader gets hauled over the coals in the most public and spectacular fashion for accepting some spectacles from a colleague, a rich colleague, while another can take a secret £5 million gift from a cryptocurrency billionaire based in Thailand, and it merits barely a mention on radio programs, television programs, and newspaper front pages. I want you to explain it to me or to everybody else listening to the program. Because if I had woken up today after being asleep for only 10 years, only 10 years, not 20, not 30, not 40, if I had been asleep for 10 years and I woke up today and you presented me with these two stories and the utter, utter chasm in coverage, I would not believe you. I would not believe you. I would have thought that British journalism was better than that. And that British journalists were better than that. And that people I have crossed swords with, but still maintained respect for, were better than that. A £5 million secret gift, to a man poised to become Prime Minister, receiving barely a mention from exactly the same people that thought Armageddon had arrived early when the man who is currently Prime Minister was reported to have accepted some free spectacles while he was still in opposition. Just explain it to me, because I don't get it. I don't get it. 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. And look, I mean, it obviously you have to pretend you don't care if whatever it is that these people are selling is something that you love. It's like with Trump, right? You get the misogyny, you get the racism, you get the climate change denial, you get the transphobia. So that's fine, but don't demean yourself by pretending that it doesn't matter. Of course it matters. It just doesn't matter enough to you because you love all the other stuff more. £5 million. Just imagine it was any other politician. Imagine it was a politician you don't like, or a politician that you are ambivalent about, or a politician you've never heard of. Ask yourself how you would, and I know you don't ring me anymore, but I still think about you. I still care about you. How would you respond if it was a politician that you didn't have a sort of fetishistic regard for? What does it say about our democracy? What does it say about our decency? What does it say about our country that he can trouser £5 million in cash, tax-free, not tell anyone, not declare it, not disclose it, and get away with it in a world where people were calling for Keir Starmer to resign over spectacles? What is going on? It's 10:22. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. The number you need is 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
Better Bad Buzz. What do you value most?
Reliability.
Quality family time.
My social life.
With Wi-Fi to keep you entertained and fares capped at £3, travelling with Metrobus gives you the time and freedom to enjoy what matters to you. Download the Metrobus app today for tickets, journey planning and live updates. Ta-da. Wherever you're heading, it's better by bus.
Better by bus.
When life gives you that hump day feeling, Deliveroo gives you the fuel to power through with a top-up shop delivered in as little as 20 minutes. Keep the fridge full with your favourite essentials from Co-op, Morrisons and Sainsbury's. And even better, our freshness promise means your fresh and chilled groceries arrive fresh or you get your money back. Deliveroo, now just got even better. Geographical restrictions, T's and C's and fees apply. Delivery times vary. See app or web for info.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadrapillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot Bears. And four giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next?
tracks, Dad.
Cannon Arena, lemurs, Jungle Kingdom go-karts, trampolines, magical wood and cafes.
Nuthatch Adventure Park.
The fun goes on and on and on and on.
Book now at nuthatch.com.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
24 minutes after 10, and that's the sad bit, isn't it? Is you know, what would we call it, footballification? We used to believe that everybody played on the same pitch. Everybody played on the same pitch. I'm obsessed with this, not just because I'm obsessed with footballification, but everybody played by the same rules, even if you would be biting chunks out of each other before half-time oranges. And here we are, comparing coverage of some spectacles to coverage of £5 million. Would you like to hear a statement from Farage's crew? Here you go. This was a personal, unconditional gift that was given before he was elected. That's all right, then. Everything has been declared in accordance with the rules. I think that's probably a wait-and-see pie there. But I don't care whether or not everything has been declared in accordance with the rules. I want to know why it receives a tiny fraction of the coverage that Keir Starmer's spectacles receive. Kevin is in Clacton, appropriately enough. Kevin, what would you like to say?
Well, you just kind of mentioned footballification, but I got that term from you anyway.
I always do, mate. I know,
and it's such a good term. I think this is, you know, like, if their player handballs it, you're all up in arms screaming at it.
It's not true, though, is it? It's not true, because when Starmer was announced, revealed to have taken these spectacles, a lot of people said, well, he had to be squeaky clean. He didn't just have to be clean. It doesn't matter whether he broke the rules or not. Perception is nine-tenths of the law. He had to be squeaky, squeaky clean. So it wasn't, no one was really coming out and saying, this is nothing, this is a great big nothing burger. People were critiquing him, but
It just reminds me of Maradona's handball. It just reminds me of that, because the Argentinians are like, he got away with it. He got away with it, and that's how we win. And it just become about winning and losing, and I don't know why the press aren't going after it. Probably you're better informed than me on that. I'd have my suspicions.
No, I haven't got a clue, mate, honestly. And we could sit here now and say, well, they obviously want him to be Prime Minister. They tried Boris Johnson. They got Liz Truss. That hasn't worked out, so they're smacking their head against another brick wall.
And I think it might just be, sadly, as simple and as awful as that.
Well, that would...
People don't want...
That would explain owners, right? That might explain why Viscount Rothermere has sent a missive to Ted Verity at the Daily Mail saying, God, this is nowhere near as bad as those spectacles, is it? Let's stick it on page 507. Or why Dick Littlejohn probably won't mention it at all. Two different things, aren't there? The columnist or the presenter going mad about the spectacles and then choosing not to talk about this is not the same as the oligarch owners thinking that their interests, whether they're cryptocurrency billionaires or whether they're television station owners, their interests are going to be best served by having him in Downing Street. I don't understand why people on my level are so morally corrupt.
Yeah, I don't know either. I just see that anyone on the right at the minute is generally in favour with the press, and anyone who's not is out of favour. And like you said, they've been going for Starmer, and I'm not a huge Labour fan or a huge Starmer fan, but from day one they've been going after him. It's obvious, and it's so obvious. I started taking interest in it all,
yes,
and now I'm just becoming really uninterested in it. I'm like, this is just awful. It's just,
you mean a what's the point scenario?
Yeah,
what's the point? What is the point of caring? What is the point of critiquing Keir Starmer for being foolish in not realising how it would look when it was reported that he'd accepted a free suit from a millionaire colleague? What is the point of caring about standards and decency? You look across the Atlantic, Kevin, and you realise that... this is where the King was so brilliant last week, isn't it? Where he just reminded us that even if everything is going south, you still have to care.
And I'm a bit of a Republican, but I think he absolutely smashed it. I was like, that's the best job he's ever done since I've been around. That was excellent work. And now I'm leaning, well, maybe we need more of that.
I'm
rethinking everything.
If you need a rich donor to buy you your glasses and your clothes, you're not fit to be Prime Minister. Go on, take a wild guess who said that a couple of years ago.
No idea.
Nigel Farage, mate. Nigel flipping Farage.
Of course he did.
If you need a rich donor to buy you your glasses and your clothes, you're not fit to be Prime Minister. But if you need a rich donor to give you 5 million quid for no apparent reason, except, I don't know, maybe he woke up that morning in a very good mood, then are you fit to be Prime Minister? And they won't ask him. They won't read these quotes back to him. There might have been one morning where they might have done. So if he'd gone on with Laura Koonsberg on Sunday, he lost his season ticket, apparently. He was booked for the programme, but he didn't turn up. He knew that even she would have to ask her that question on that day. Next time he goes on, free pass. No question. So what do we care about? And you sit here thinking, oh, never mind. But it's America. That's the thing that frightens me. It's looking at what happens when everybody abandons decency. And it starts with the media, actually. And then it's the colleagues. And then you've got an absolute reprobate running around the corridors of power doing whatever he wants, making Boris Johnson look responsible. But I want to talk about the 5 million quid. I want to talk about the spectacles, and I want you to tell me what is happening or has happened in our country. That's all. And tell me I'm an idiot. Tell me it's always been like this, and we can have a bit of an argument. Or tell me that it's no big deal. Tell me that it makes perfect sense. One of them's Prime Minister, one of them's an opposition leader. Just have a crack at it. Because otherwise it's just going to be me and Kevin and everybody else sitting here rolling our eyes and going, shush, whoosh. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
Counter-terror police are investigating an arson attack at a former synagogue in East London. Officers were called to reports of a fire at a building in Tower Hamlets in the early hours of this morning. It comes as Sir Keir Starmer's held a summit with leaders from across public life to discuss how to tackle anti-Semitism. Speaking from Number 10, Sir Keir's called attacks on the Jewish community a crisis and a test of our values. And there's growing concerns for the ceasefire between the US and Iran after they traded fire around the Strait of Hormuz. American forces have been trying to reopen the key trading waterway to commercial shipping. LBC weather, sunshine and showers for large parts of the UK. Some wintry downpours possible on higher ground for northern Scotland. A warm day for most, a high of 18 degrees.
This is LBC.
Hi, I'm Sava, founder of Cool You, the daddy of air conditioning. For over 15 years, Cool You have specialized in installing our fully internal aircon systems with no mess, no fuss, and no external condenser. Perfect for modern apartments, conservation areas, listed properties, or simply for those who don't want an ugly unit on the outside. Head to coolyou.london. Cool You, for a cool, comfortable home.
Shine Night Walk London is a 10K, half marathon or full marathon supported walk around the city at night on the 19th of September to raise vital money for Cancer Research UK. It's also
everyone walking with all their colours, twinkling away.
We can actually see how nice London is. And London is different at night time.
Celebration of life, and it gives hope.
Step towards a brighter future at shinewalk.org today to get 30% off your entry. Together, we are beating cancer. T's and C's apply.
Canal Adventures in St Pancras.
That's a new one for us.
Oh, kids, cafe this way.
Oh, eat your heart out, Venice. This is lovely.
What's that?
Yes, I have both Captain Nats for the boat ride.
Train back.
So that was two pastries, one boat ride, and no tantrums. Result.
Love this shot of them driving the boat.
Download the Thameslink Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
Rotimi likes PensionBee's modern approach to pensions.
I think PensionBee has brought pensions into the 21st century, firstly through the use of technology. Signing up to the app is super simple. PensionBee makes me feel very confident about my finances and makes me feel like I have a plan when it comes to my retirement.
At PensionBee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to PensionBee.com and be pension confident. When investing, your capital is at risk.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
It's 33 minutes after 10. I mean, the mad thing is, when you think about it, all the phone-ins we've done expressing shock at what is happening in the United States of America, and, you know, I didn't think it could happen there, we would say. I thought that was the kind of thing that could only happen in Hungary or in North Korea. I thought that the Founding Fathers, when they put the Constitution together, had guarded against such absolute abandonment of decency. And now we're having a conversation that suggests we could be heading down a very similar road. How can a senior politician accept a £5 million secret donation from a foreign-based billionaire shortly before announcing policy plans that would enrich that foreign-based billionaire to the to wealth beyond our wildest dreams and not get anything like the coverage that another politician got for buying a field for his disabled mother to keep distressed donkeys in and turning a profit on said field a few years later, or accepting some spectacles and a suit from a fellow member of parliament, a Labour member of the House of Lords. Do you see what I mean now? Because I mean, a couple of messages coming in, but I mean, Idiot's Corner isn't really big enough for people saying, oh, well, the left went after Keir Starmer, so now went after Boris Johnson, so now the right are going after Keir Starmer. I can't really deal with people like you, because you will never admit that you don't care what they do, your heroes, as long as they endorse your racism, your misogyny, your climate change denial, or, as a smaller dish, but still a poisonous one, your transphobia. Okay, there's no point, is there? I mean, I've watched it happen with Trump. Oh, I don't care about a politician exit. It's upsetting all the right people. £5 million secret donor. Well, how would you feel if a politician that didn't indulge your racism or your anti-Semitism or your homophobia or whatever it is, how would you feel if a politician... Oh, well, I'd be outraged. I'd be resignated. He'd have to go. He'd have to go. We sit here going, oh, it couldn't happen here. No, we're better than that. We're a Western liberal democracy. Do you want a little bit more of the statement that they gave to us last week when we were asking questions about this? The two are entirely unrelated. That's the £5 million gift to a man who said he wasn't going to go back into politics, and then went back into politics after getting the £5 million gift. The two are entirely unrelated. This gift was given when Nigel was retired from frontline politics. I think he was chair of Reform UK at the time. A while after the gift was given, Nigel confirmed he wouldn't stand at the next general election. He then reversed his decision to stand in June. I've got no way of checking the chronology here. I'll just read out what they're saying. Secret £5 million gift to a man who would be Prime Minister. Now, listen, we could speculate all day long on whether or not it is feasible that you would make a gift like that in expectation of absolutely nothing in return. No, I don't want anything. Here's £5 million. I think he's claimed it was for security reasons, while simultaneously claiming, after receiving it, that he couldn't hold parliamentary constituency surgeries in Clacton because of security reasons. But it doesn't matter, does it? I want to find one of these messages. There's not enough coming in. It's not like the good old days when everyone thought Brexit was going to go brilliantly. Pretending that it doesn't matter. So we'll, because you often get accused when you pursue my politics of looking down on people who voted for Brexit or looking down on people who vote according to whatever the Sun or the Daily Mail has told them to do. The opposite is true. The opposite is true. Nobody holds those people in lower regard than the people manipulating them and harvesting their votes and support. Literally nobody. Those of us on the other side of the political divide, I give credit where credit is due, benefit of the doubt. Everybody's capable of decency if they're given half a chance. But if you want to make a bunch of money in this country, whether online or on Fleet Street, just pander to everybody's worst imaginable prejudices. £5 million versus three pairs of spectacles and a suit. Make it make sense. Josephine's in Westminster. Josephine, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Well, I think I see it on two levels, really. So firstly, regarding the journalists, I think Simon Marks provided the answer to that last week when he talked about the journalists who were basically complicit in keeping Trump in power in the States because they have access to his phone number, and he rings them up and talks to them like for hours about policy. And I think the journalists here are looking over the pond and they want a similar situation. So they're thinking Farage might get into power and they want that level of access when he does. And then I think there's also a certain class of people who
pause. Because I think there's something in that. And Simon Marks almost speaks ex cathedra when he pontificates on such matters. But why would you lose access to him but not lose access to Starmer? I mean, they've been embarked upon the most extraordinary... Well, every Labour leader endures hatchet job after hatchet job after donkey sanctuary after spectacles after dead father maligned in the pages of the Daily Mail. So, I mean, I subscribe to the access argument, but I don't think it covers all of the territory that we're exploring here.
Well, the rest, I think, is just money. It's just greed, essentially. I mean, if you look at the policies that Labour are bringing in, I'm not Starmer's greatest fan, but things like the renter's rights bill, I mean, those are things that should have been enshrined in UK law decades ago. That they make us stand out against any other European country. And you read headlines like The Times saying that there aren't going to be any rental properties left in this country, when every other European country that has these kind of laws manifestly has a rental market that is flourishing. So
I've got that story in front of me. I think there is going to be a short-term negative impact of this legislation.
Short-term, but anyone who has any knowledge of economics and economic history sees that these things tend to somehow balance themselves out over time. And once you create a market, it's just regulation that comes in, short-term effect, and then in the long run, you end up with an actually vibrant market that works for everyone.
So are we actually, and this is where I worry about that question of condescension, are we actually wondering how many British people can be so silly or can be so unable to see what is unfolding under their very noses? £5 million. No, fine, nothing to see here.
I think there's been a concerted effort in this country over decades, if not centuries, to really keep people essentially, to not educate people and not give them access to the truth, and worse still, not give them access to the information. So people see 5 million, just like they saw 250 million on the side of a bus.
Mm.
And they kind of, they have no sense of how big that is in comparison. So in comparison to Starmer, because the numbers aren't presented like that. They're presented like, oh, it's just 5 million. It's just, you know, it's just that amount. And it's not presented next to Starmer, next to the amount that Starmer apparently was given. You know, so there's the comparison.
Well, he wasn't given any money. He accepted £2,485,000 worth of spectacles and suit. £2,485 worth.
And I think there's actually a class in this country who have access to power and to the media, who almost see this kind of corruption and think, oh, okay, actually we do want that because
why do you think we're in this business?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what happened during COVID, people literally saw COVID and thought, how can I make money out of this? And almost wanted to, like, they were almost happy that someone like Boris was in power, because it meant that they could be corrupt and take as much as they could from the state and bleed the straight dry. And that's what's happened time and time again. You see it with the privatization of things like water. I mean, these are fundamental things that have been brewing in our society for a long time and that have set the scene for this.
And you can't do the really bad stuff unless you've seeded the ground beforehand. And we've seen what happened in the United States of America. You mentioned water companies. The Asset Class by Hetty O'Brien looks at how private equity turned capitalism against itself. And Hetty will be joining me at about 12:30 today, Josephine, to talk about her new book. I have a feeling it'll be right up your strasser. And it looks at some of the stuff that Josephine just touched on. If you are in the business of making money, that's all that you care about, then that's all that you care about. You don't care about whether or not the rivers are full of sewage. You don't care about whether or not care homes are unfit for purpose. You don't care about whether or not the railways run. You just care about money. You want money. And if you can make more money by having a politician in your pocket, then you will try to get a politician in your pocket, which is one form of political donation to political parties. Some people, I think, make a ton of money and want to give something back to society. I can't think of many off the top of my head. I think Clive Hollick, former Labour peer, he was quite a good example of this. Bill Gates, I suppose, in some ways, before he was deeply tarnished by his appearances in the Epstein files. Sometimes you make a ton of money and you think, I'd like society to be a better place. Other times you make a ton of money and therefore you make donations accordingly. Other times you make a ton of money and you think, do you know what, I'd really like a ton more money. And then you make your donations accordingly. And the rest of us sit here, I don't know, like mugs? James is in Leeds. James, what would you like to say?
Hello, James. Oh, God, I'm so angry. I've been angry about this ever since I heard about it.
Forgive me for the crassness of this question. How do you maintain your anger when all around you are staying calm or not caring?
Well, I'm becoming hopeless, James. I'm sorry, but I'm just becoming hopeless. Yeah. I find it. Ultimately, I think with this story, the reason I was going to call in is that the size of the donation is shocking, and the other donations as well. But the key to all of this is why that money's being given and the potential dangers to what could happen if we had a prime minister who was prepared to deregulate the cryptocurrency market. And apparently the figures show that this guy, this donor, could become the 30th richest man in the world. Now, we have no proof that there's, you know, that there's a direct link between the donations and what may happen.
No, and that will be denied by all involved.
Yes. Yes,
it's just a coincidence that the bloke who gave him 5 million quid secretly will become one of the richest men on the planet as a consequence of policies that he will introduce. That's what we're being asked to believe. It's important that we understand what we're being asked to believe. Yes. I make no judgment. I make no comment on the plausibility of what we're being asked to believe. But we're being asked to believe that it's an extraordinary coincidence.
But yes. Yes, and on the other hand, you know, you have a millionaire himself, Lord Alley, who gave £200,000. Well, what, you know, was he doing that because he wanted some financial return on that? You know, it just, that doesn't hold up, you know.
It doesn't matter, does it? That's the thing. I think we also, I don't know whether we sound naive or defeated or, I mean, you know, the people who claim that they don't care or that they welcome this or that there's nothing to see here. I mean, how deep do you have to dig into them to actually understand how they can't care about the things that you care about, regardless of who's doing them? Someone gives Keir Starmer secretly 5 million quid, and then by complete coincidence, Keir Starmer announces that when he becomes Prime Minister, he's going to bring in laws that will make you one of the richest people on the planet. How can you not care about that?
Well, you can't care if you don't know. And I think that's getting back to the, it's the fact that, you know, I'm sure that a large proportion of the
election. It's just me being paranoid. I hear you, but we're not discussing anything to do with Thursday's elections. But I mean, we can certainly speculate about the sagacity or otherwise of our fellow men and women. I wish again that we had the technology to, account how many people are hearing about this for the first. I mean, I've done it on the show. I did it on the show towards the end of last week. But then you get the long bank holiday weekend. He manages to duck out of interviews that had previously been scheduled without providing any meaningful excuse. He offers up some challengeable claim about his own personal security, which was also the reason he gave for why he couldn't have surgeries in his constituency. So either he's spent the money on security or he hasn't spent the money on security. And of course the claim that his home had been firebombed, a terrible, terrible claim that, so far, we've been unable to establish which police service that was reported to. And it will just go away like it did with Trump. I think when you look back on Donald Trump, what's the thing that you think should have broken it? Is it the grabbing women by their, I'm not going to say the word on the radio, boasting about sexual assaults effectively? Something that Nigel Farage defended, of course, and inevitably. Was it that? Was that when you thought, well, that's got to be it now? Or you look back now and think, well, that should have been it. That should have finished things. The abuse of the disabled newspaper reporter doing a sort of impression of his symptoms. I come back often to the Gold Star military veteran, the dead soldier who happened to be Muslim. So Donald Trump insulted his parents. Or John McCain, the military hero that Donald Trump insulted. I mean, how many of those milestones on the road to what they have now were visible from space? And we don't yet know the full extent of Donald Trump's financial dealings. I mean, it is an extraordinary coincidence that large bets are placed on prediction markets shortly before announcements come out of the Oval Office. It's an extraordinary coincidence that members of his family have made huge sums of money from cryptocurrency investments that have benefited enormously from him being president. But when you think back to Trump, what things do you think of as the things that shouldn't have just set the alarm bells ringing? They should have had everybody rushing for the fire exit. Because here we are. Here we are. £5 million, what for? Well, nothing. I expect nothing in return. £5 million, how do you make your money? Cryptocurrency. Farage doing anything with cryptocurrency? Yeah, he's gonna make it even more lucrative so that I could become one of the richest people on the planet. Complete coincidence that you gave him £5 million, though. Yes, absolutely a complete coincidence. I have no reason to challenge that. I'm just, counting.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature, biotiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful Gut Health. Switch your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and give your gut and your summer a lift. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
For whoever they want to be in life, give them a great start with WellKid. Carefully balanced, great-tasting vitamins and minerals for 4 to 12-year-olds with specific nutrients such as zinc and vitamin D, which support normal immune system function. The WellKid range from Vitabiotics, from Boots, pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
At John Lewis Money, we know your home is more than an address. It's the sunlight pouring in. Well, sometimes. The coffee on tap and the best spot on the sofa. It's why our home insurance is thoughtfully designed with 3 levels of flexible cover for the home you've created. Because when you notice the details, you notice the difference. Search John Lewis Money. Terms and exclusions apply. John Lewis Finance Limited is authorized for insurance distribution and credit broking by the Financial Conduct Authority.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
10:52 is the time. Patriotic millionaires, that they call themselves, and they get a fraction of the coverage that is secured by the people that secretly fund Tufton Street lobby groups masquerading as think tanks, because one is spending a bunch of money on enriching themselves further, and the other is spending a bunch of money on supporting politics that would see them pay more tax. I'll leave you to work out why one of those groups gets a lot more coverage than the other. But why on earth would a story about £5 million in a secret donation to a prominent British politician get less coverage than a story about 3 pairs of spectacles in a declared donation after advice was sought to a British politician? And listen, I mean, I'm going to have to keep an eye on this for a long time, I imagine. Not just this story, but what it represents. And it's fine. It's absolutely fine. I'd rather you were listening to me and pretending that you don't care or pretending that you love it than listening to the echo chamber you spend the rest of your life in, where you'd be enraged by Keir Starmer's spectacles and supremely comfortable with Nigel Farage's £5 million. £5 million Farage. And if you don't care about that, you don't actually care about anything. But here you are, proving your patriotism by hanging a tatty flag from your local roundabout lamppost. Jordan's in Wembley. Jordan, what would you like to say?
Hi. Yeah, I'd just like to say I'm not really surprised that, you know,
Keir Starmer's got more backlash compared to Nigel Farage. I think it's quite normal for people to have their favourites and to work within their conflict of interest.
I mean, I'm not surprised, but I'm shocked. I'm shocked at the comparison that occurred to me this morning. It's a £5 million secret donation versus a few pairs of spectacles. And people who do what I do for a living had heart attacks about the latter and have said not a syllable about the former. I think what surprises me, Jordan, is that you haven't even had lip service being paid to the story. You haven't even, well, this looks a bit rum. Perhaps we'll ask him about this next time he's in the studio, or this is, you've not even, as far as I'm aware, had some very prominent critics of Keir Starmer even acknowledging the existence of the story, which is different from normal service. It's almost as if they know it's so disgusting, they can't afford to mention it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I assume they maybe think he, you know, what's his party called again?
Oh, it's so hard to keep up. The Brexit Party, is it? No, that was the last one. UKIP. No, that was the one before.
Oh, darn.
Oh, come on. Reform.
There we go, yeah. So I guess because they assume they're going to win, it's just not in favour of them to really speak out. And once again, it's kind of normal human nature.
I mean, it's not normal human nature, mate. Is it? No. I mean, normal human nature is to be even more let down when someone you admire does something bad than you are when someone that you don't admire does something bad. Have a little listen to this. This is Nigel Farage on LBC in September of last year.
Tether is a stable coin. Stable coins are the way which money goes from conventional currencies through into cryptocurrencies and back again. Tether is about to be valued as a $500 billion company. You know, stable coins, crypto, this world is enormous. And I've been urging for years that London should embrace it. We should become a global trading centre for this stuff under proper regulation. And the governor of the Bank of England earlier this week indicated that nobody, no individual, should be allowed to have more than £10,000 worth of stable coins. To which some of my friends have said, should we just emigrate? Why is the bank so out of touch? Why is it behaving like a dinosaur? Why not get with the 21st century? These new technologies aren't going away.
I don't know if he knows it or not. He's already emigrated, mate. He lives in Thailand and he gave you £5 million while owning 12% of the company that you were just bigging up in an unpaid advert live on this radio station. So the bloke that gave Nigel Farage £5 million, secretly, owns 12% of the company that Nigel Farage is advertising here.
Tether is a stable coin. Stable coins are the way which money goes from conventional currencies through into...
They're going to emigrate. Lives in Thailand. The bloke who literally... Do you think you should have mentioned it during that interview? Some of my friends... I'll tell you who's really cross about this. The one who just gave me £5 million. And we sit here being all British. Well, we're not, are we, though? We're not being all British. The British used to hate this kind of thing. There is no need to bribe or twist, thank God the British journalist, for seeing what the man will do unbribed, there's no occasion to. I never understood that before. That was like my dad's profession. That's what I wanted to do when I grew up. I still do want to do it, if and when I grow up. I always thought that was a really unfair. I think it's 19th century. Sounds a bit Victorian, doesn't it? I always thought that was really unfair. Don't laugh at me. This is a noble... My dad was a noble man. Lots of journalists that I've known over the years are good and noble people. And now I am watching a man advertising a cryptocurrency company that his secret £5 million donor owns 12% of, and people electing not even to mention the existence of the story. My friends.
And the governor of the Bank of England earlier this week indicated that nobody, no individual, should be allowed to have more than £10,000 worth of stable coins. To which some of my friends have said, shall we just emigrate?
Which friends, mate? Which friends? Because he can't be Christopher Harborne. He's already emigrated. He uses a Thai name to do business in Thailand. And he just gave you, shortly before that appearance on LBC, he gave you £5 million. We can only speculate on how scandalous and outraged the story would be if he'd accepted three pairs of spectacles worth something in the region of $2,500. That's it. I mean, it's a complete coincidence that the company that he chose to talk up there live on the radio is the company that 12% of which is owned by the man who had recently given him a secret donation of £5 million. And it's not invisible, this story. It hasn't disappeared. But the people who are exercised by it are the people you would expect or hope to be exercised by it. All four of us. The people who were, or pretended to be, or were genuinely outraged by Keir Starmer's spectacles have been absolutely silent. And that is, I don't even know what the word would be, but that is a little bit like looking the other way when Donald Trump abused the disabled man, boasted about sexual assault, or insulted war veterans.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, counter-terror police are investigating an arson attack at a former synagogue in East London. Police were called to reports of a fire in Tower Hamlets in the early hours of this morning. LBC's reporter Fraser Knight has more details.
As the Prime Minister meets with faith groups, health bosses and university leaders in Number 10, counter-terror police say there's been another suspected arson attack in East London on a now disused synagogue. They say it's happened around 10 past five this morning, and a first look at CCTV suggests the fire was started deliberately. It's caused damage to a set of gates and a lock on the front of the building. The head of counter-terrorism policing is among the people who's meeting with Keir Starmer this morning.
The Prime Minister has warned Iran that attempts to incite anti-Semitism in Britain will not be tolerated. It comes amid suspicions that Tehran could be backing anti-Semitic attacks in the UK. So Keir Starmer is meeting leaders from across public life to discuss an action plan to tackle the issue. Speaking in Downing Street in the past hour, Sir Keir urged the leaders of the arts, business and university sectors to act with urgency.
We're calling on universities to demonstrate action. We will now expect them to publish the scale of the problem on their campuses, as well as the specific steps they have taken to clamp down on it. There will be zero tolerance for inaction. In our cultural venues and spaces, we will also expect more. Where public funding is being used to promote or platform anti-Semitism, the Arts Council must act.
Concerns are growing of a full-scale return to hostilities after the US and Iran traded fire around the Strait of Hormuz. It follows Donald Trump's claim that the US Navy guided two American-flagged ships out of the waterway yesterday. Tehran has effectively blockaded the key route during the two-month conflict. Efforts are continuing to try and get hundreds of people off a cruise ship in the Atlantic Ocean, which is at the centre of the hantavirus outbreak. Officials in Cape Verde are refusing to let the ship dock, saying that passengers can't leave to try and protect locals. And a report has found higher living costs, debt and insecure work leading to more exploitation of British people. The Anti-Slavery Commissioner has warned that advances in technology is making it easier for criminals to recruit and control victims. The government says it is working with survivors to inform new policy. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 102 points at 10,261. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 15. LBC weather, sunshine and showers for large parts of the UK. Some wintry showers possible on higher ground for northern Scotland. A warm day for most, though, a high of 18 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
OK, I want you to close your eyes and think of your car. Now I want you to imagine yourself selling that car and getting a really great price for it. You just got the best offer for your car, like 500,000 other customers. It's not magic, it's Motorway. Sell your car for more at motorway.co.uk. 84% of sellers got more than market price for their car. Validated against two independent sources. Visit motorway.co.uk/claims.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 3 minutes after 11 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. There's a fascinating correlation almost. I would choose, be careful what I say. Who was I talking to about this the other day? See if you can remember, because I presume it was on the radio. It's like the people at the very top of society and the people at the very bottom of society are the two freest constituencies of all. It may have been on a Full Disclosure episode. Everybody in between, the sort of absolutely ginormous middle classes, are constrained by, I mean, everything from social traditions and mores, financial considerations, whatever it may be. But people at the very bottom of society, sort of as depicted in the television program Shameless, and then people at the very top, people are so rich they can do whatever they want without any real fear of consequences, are free. And everybody else is in some way constrained. And what constrains us, in many ways, civilizes us. Without constraints, we are civilized. But I'm just trying to remember when I was a kid, when I was a boy, how often we went out as a family and how normal our timetable was. I've talked about my dad quite a lot today. He was, as I mentioned, a newspaper journalist. And so it's during an era where you couldn't be a newspaper journalist without spending quite a lot of time in the pub. I think I had my first ever pint in a pub in Birmingham that was bought for me by the head of the Serious Crime Squad, despite the fact that I was at West Midlands Police Serious Crime Squad, who, it turned out, were not exactly lily white in their approach to law and order, but I was underage, so I perhaps could have seen a clue on the horizon about what was going on there. But I never went to the pub as a child particularly. It was a sort of bottle of dandelion and burdock and a packet of crisps in the car on the rare occasions that Mum and Dad would go in. I'm trying to remember the restaurant visits that we'd do. And they were real treats, you know. I mean, Mum and Dad obviously went out for dinner a bit and we'd have a babysitter. But nowhere near as often as I was doing 10 years ago, say. I read an article the other day about a reset in socialising, and it suggested that we did a lot less of it in the 70s and 80s, and then, for reasons, we did a lot more of it subsequently. And now it might be going back again. So, you know, eating out or going to a bar or a pub. I don't know how we'd measure this. Do the numbers exist? That we've been going through something of a golden era. Even as, of course, pubs have started closing at a rate of knots. We would all spend more of our disposable income. Or did we have more disposable? Well, we had more disposable income for that period than we did in the 70s. Things started picking up in the 80s, and then by the 90s, we're out all the time. I mention this because there are two stories in the news today. Pubs have been closing at a rate of almost two every day, reports the Daily Telegraph, which is a reflection of roughly where things have been for a while now, although the Daily Telegraph, understandably, are very keen to blame it all on Rachel Reeves, as if until this government got in, pubs were opening up and down the country at a rate of knots. And the other story, in a different paper, is that the pint in London, the I don't think it's an average yet, but it is becoming ever more commonplace where you will spend, and if you're listening to this in the north, you might want to sit down, you'll spend more than £10 on a pint. The £10 pint is here. The average is still about £6.48, but by the time you've factored in some of the fancy-schmancy venues and some of the fancy-schmancy brews, you get the £10 pint. I've had an expensive pint in some relatively normal pubs, but it's your sort of premium craft beer, IPA, cliche, centrist dad, .com pint. I don't remember ever paying more than £10 a pint. But more and more people are. I can't help seeing these two stories as being very intimately related to each other. Most pubs are not going to be charging over £10 a pint, but it has become commonplace enough to merit a news story. And then you've got the other story about pubs shutting. And I've touched on this with you before because I think it's really interesting. I love, more than anything else on this programme, I love talking to you about change. I love change. I love transformation. It's the opposite way, traditionally, of doing radio phone-in programmes. A traditional radio phone-in host will be presenting the same programme in 2026 that they were presenting in 1996. They just take it in turns to decide whether it's travellers or migrants or single mothers or people on welfare. Who's going to get a kicking today? And you just roll the wheel in the morning and you come on air and you go, oh, aren't those migrants awful? Or you roll the wheel again on a Wednesday and you come on air and go, oh, aren't those people claiming disability benefit awful? And you roll the wheel again and you go, oh, aren't those single mothers awful? Single mothers get a fairly easy time of it at the moment, don't they? That's probably something that will change in the next couple of years or so, although possibly society has moved on sufficiently. I suppose all the children of single mothers have grown up and won't tolerate the bigotry and hatred that was engendered against their mothers 10, 20, 30 years ago. So I love transformation, and I like conversations that recognise sometimes uncomfortable change, things that we don't think we want to change, and we think that because they are changing, there must be something wrong. But a lot of change is incremental. A lot of change is simply society changing. Our relationship with alcohol is changing all the time. The days of everybody thinking it was absolutely fine to get stocious on a regular basis are behind us. We are bombarded, for good or for ill, because a lot of the public health messaging is cancelled out by the amount of money being spent on advertising the stuff that we're being warned about. But a lot of information and education about alcohol has reached us. Changes to legislation. I mean, drink driving in the 1970s and possibly into the 1980s was absolutely endemic. Extraordinary to think that they had to run massive advertising campaigns to discourage people from getting behind the wheel of their car with the children in the back and driving home from the pub. I mean, genuinely, it was so widespread. This is what I mean by transformation. Do you see why that is fascinating? So not only would you get behind the wheel of the car having had six pints, but your children would be in the back and none of you would be wearing seatbelts. That's the country I grew up in. Oh, that almost sounded nostalgic. That was normal when I was growing up. Not the drink driving in my family, but the widespread practice being so endemic that the government felt the need to advertise the dangers of drink driving. That's kind of gone away now. And the seatbelts have gone away now. The idea that you need to be compelled or ordered. I just find myself wondering whether the country's relationship with the pub or with a pub has actually reached critical mass. Whether actually we are no longer going to be a nation of pub goers. And there are two or three questions thrown up by this. The first is, what will that do? What will that do? I don't want to sound silly or any sillier than usual or unintentionally silly, but some of my loveliest memories were in pubs. I courted Mrs. O'Brien in a pub, well, in various pubs, actually. Some of my firmest friendships were formed in pubs. Some of my funniest times unfolded in pubs. I love pubs from the age, well, pretty much from when I arrived in Manchester. Before I even went to university, I started spending a lot of time in pubs. The pubs of Chalton cum Hardy still have a very warm spot in my heart. And I'm not a sociable person. If you, drop me in the middle of a birthday party where I don't know many people. It's my idea of hell on earth. But in a pub, someone at the next table starts talking to you. You talk back. One of the maddest experiences of my life was in a pub in Romilly, just outside Stockport, where I found myself spending an entire afternoon with three men who'd spent the previous evening nicking the copper off a church roof up the road. And I checked the local paper. It was true. No, I didn't report them. So, I mean, obviously, as I've got older, I've done it less and less. But my grandma was a publican. She was a pub landlady, but I never knew her. So pubs have been part of my middle-class, centrist, dad, clichéd existence in ways that are probably a bit out of the ordinary, a bit different. So, what will it do when they are no longer... Well, there's three questions. So the first is, why did you stop going? And what difference did it make to your life? Positive or negative or both? 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. What gap? Well, no, because gap's a negative, isn't it? So it could be a... So why did you stop going? And what difference did it make? Okay? I think the question even before that is, are we in the midst of an unstoppable decline? Is it, I mean, listen, of course, chancellors of the Exchequer can always do more to help all businesses. But what you can't do is stop the tide from coming in. Is the pub industry now in a place where we're recalibrating on a national scale? So certain types of pubs will survive, but a lot of the older traditional models of pub will disappear. So that's the political or the social angle. So we've got the personal and we've got the political. The personal is the difference it made to you when you stopped going. The political is, are we actually looking at now a nationwide decline that we're all going to rub our hands about and be, not rub our hands, we're all going to, you know, what's the word? Clutch our pearls or wring our hands. But actually, we're just watching society change. We're just watching society embrace less pub-based socialising. But then there's the third question, is what difference will that make? What hole does a pub leave in a life or a village? I mean, an abandoned church, in fact it's a former synagogue in the news at the moment as a site of another arson attack, it would appear, in the early hours of this morning. I don't have the same emotional relationship with former mosques or synagogues or temples that I have with an abandoned church, because I went to church a lot as a kid. So an abandoned church speaks to me of social change. It's crikey. I spend a lot of time in Norfolk, as you know, where you can buy churches and turn them into houses. Quite a lot of people have. I look at these churches, which are sometimes in... I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I say they are in the middle of nowhere. There's one in particular where I think they do one service now, once a month, on the last Sunday of every month. And I used to be on one of my walks, one of my favourite walks in Norfolk. And I used to look at it. And I just imagine what an enormous role that church played in that area's life. Because no one had cars. You would walk to church. And the nearest village was a 40-minute walk. I mean, it was, you have these churches. It's not just in Norfolk. It just happens to be a part of England that I know rather well. I look at these churches, which are like, almost like a ship in the middle of an ocean. A church that has been dropped from the sky, equidistant from five or six different villages, all of which are quite far away from it. And on Sundays, everybody would convene. Everyone, you'd have processions, I imagine. I'm thinking like mid to late 19th century, maybe early 20th. You'd have processions of people going to church. And no one could ever imagine anything being different. No one could ever imagine any of those churches being shut. Whereas now, I mean, the lucky ones have been turned into houses. The unlucky ones have got trees growing out the roof. And there's a little bit of me that wonders whether pubs are going the same way. We just do not go to the pub in the way that we used to. And I wonder what gap that will leave. I mean, I've never done a phone-in about what gap the closures of churches have left in our lives or other places of worship, but perhaps I could have done, I should have done. What does it do to a community when a pub shuts? Because if I'm right about the first thing, which is that we are on a period of incremental and relatively straightforward decline and closure, then the second thing is actually a difficult question to answer, because you can't ring me up and tell me, oh, well, it will do this and it will do that and it will do the other. And I say, well, when's the last time you went to a pub? And you say 1978. Do you see what I mean? Are they just, is it natural, this decline? I always get there in the end, Keith. That's the word I want. Is pub closures part of a natural decline? Or has it are they victims of something more sinister, something political? So your personal relationship, what would your life be without a pub? Why did you stop going to the pub? What difference did it make when you did? Why could you never? 0345 60 60 973. And is this decline actually natural? Because I sit here wringing my hands about the £10 pint and the two pubs a day. I like pubs. I happen to live in a part of London that has several excellent pubs. I'm very lucky, actually, as it goes. But which pubs are shutting? Is it the pubs that are, if you like, natural wastage, a natural decline? And then, what difference will it make, or has it made? What will it do to society to have fewer pubs? I think that's enough for you to get your teeth into, isn't it? If you hit the numbers now, you will get through. Slightly different conversation from the one that we had in the last hour, but no less interesting for that. 0345 60 60 973. Churches used to be everywhere, and they're not anymore. And there would have been, had there been radio phone-ins during that period, there would have been an awful lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth about the closure of churches and the impact it was going to have on our society. What impact will the closure of pubs have on our society? Is it having on our society? Is it natural? What's going on? And then give me your personal on this as well, not just the political. 0345 60 60 973.
This is LBC. Ready for a new kitchen? Wix Kitchen Experts can support you with clever designs and a professional installation. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
Combine your pensions with PensionBee and take control of your retirement. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature, biotiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful Gut Health. Switch your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and give your gut and your summer a lift. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less less. Irish Ferries, see travel differently. T's and C's apply.
With up to £3,000 every year towards career growth at Amazon, I started in the warehouse knowing I could train in things like coding or robotics. It turns my job into a career. So it means I can be who I want to be, even if I haven't quite decided who that is yet.
Amazon, opening doors with up to £3,000 every year towards career growth. Eligibility conditions about type and duration of employment apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
Has anything replaced it? Sort of community nucleus, a community centre. Some parts of, where was I recently? And the pub sort of doubles up as a village shop. I was in Scotland. What replaces it? If it's like a centre of a community and it shuts, what happens next? 22 after 11 is the time. Oh, Scotland it is. Alex is in Glasgow. Alex, what made you pick up the phone?
Hello, James. Hello, I hope you're well.
Very well indeed.
Thank you. Well, I was just listening to you, and like, again, I was reading that there are two pubs a day closing somewhere in the UK. And again, I was listening to what you were saying, and I was agreeing with you. You know, the price of things going, pints going through the roof.
Yes.
You were talking about the £10 pint and down in London. Well, Edinburgh is very like that. I live in Glasgow, but I go through to Edinburgh a lot, and especially during the festival. And the prices skyrocket. It's eye-watering how much you're paying for basically a pint of cheap lager. You know, this isn't even craft beers. This is really your bog-standard lager, or heavy, as we call it in Scotland. You call it bitter. And it's just ridiculous. But on your last thing there about what happens when communities lose their pub, I've noticed... Yes. In places like the Western Highlands, the community has taken over the pub. I think this has also happened in the north of England, where the local community have actually clubbed together and bought the pub.
Well, this is why I this is why I find half of your analysis fascinating and the other half perhaps less fascinating, because there is going to be wastage. The kind of places you describe in Edinburgh are presumably making quite good money selling.
Oh, yeah.
That business model works, but that business model...
My eldest son is a bar manager in Edinburgh for quite a posh pub, and yes, they make a lot of cash.
But the days of you know, the sort of sticky floor and the table in the corner and the one man and his dog and those pubs are obviously not washing their faces anymore.
They're not.
And I don't think it's necessarily, and I always have sympathy for people losing their jobs or their livelihoods or their homes, but I don't necessarily think it's a national tragedy for failing pubs to close.
No, I agree with you with that, but it's sad to see them go, like yourself.
Yes, it
my
is.
My formative years were spent around about pubs and clubs and things like that. I made many, many friends.
But it's sad to see churches go. If we were having this conversation 100 years ago, there'd probably be a greater rationale for saying, well, churches are closing, everyone's going to start thieving and committing adultery and accepting secret £5 million gifts from curious...
Yes. Well, maybe Nige could actually save a couple of these pubs by investing his money in them. You know,
he needs it all for security, mate.
All right.
Here's a question for...
Edinburgh pubs, because the last time he was up here, that's how he had to barricade himself into it.
Here is a question. Here is a question for the ages. Yeah. Right? East of England, 16 closures. West Midlands, 11 closures. Southwest, 13 closures. Northwest, 18 closures. Scotland, 41 closures. East Midlands, 10 closures. Northeast, 2 closures. London, 17 closures. Yorkshire and the Humber, 10 closures. Wales, 3 openings.
Well,
what is happening in Wales?
Perhaps Wales are getting better paid jobs.
Could be that. I don't know what it is. Why on earth would the number of pubs be going up? It could be what you allude to, actually, and it could be old pubs reopening because the community have decided to do something about it, or I could be talking out the top of my head. I would quite like to know, though, why Wales is the only part of the United Kingdom wherein pubs have gone up in the last year, as opposed to gone down. Thank you, Alex. What does it leave, though? Does it leave anything? I don't know. I'm glad to hear that the pubs of Chorlton Cumhardy are still going strong. Thank you for that, Raj. Ian's on the Isle of Wight. Ian, what would you like to say?
All right, mate. How's it going?
It's all good. What made you pick up the phone?
Because you always manage to hit whatever's been bugging me right on the spot. So I think... Basically, I've thought for a long time that the breakdown in British society is directly related to the decline of the pub. Back in the day, you sat at home, you know, people didn't have mobile phones, there's no social media, and you sat there and you thought to yourself, what shall I do tonight? I'm really bored, there's nothing on telly, there's no Sky.
Yes.
You go down the pub to see what your mates were doing. And that would be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Super Sunday as well. whereas now, it's like people don't need to do that. Also, the reason that they don't, like even... And then there was a while that people would just go out on Friday, Saturday night. But, you know, I'm a DJ, so I see this happening all the time. They're not bothering on a Friday or Saturday night, literally, because it's just too expensive. What are you saying, £10 a pint somewhere?
Well, so, okay, why are they opening up in Wales? So, I mean, the numbers are not, you know, absolutely huge, but Wales seems to be bucking the more general trend. I don't think that there's more money in Wales or more... Or less distraction, or less social media. I don't know. I mean, it's a side order.
It's just an anomaly.
It could just be a glitch.
But like you talk to like these politicians and people. I have a way to fix it. Can I tell you?
Go on. Yeah, of course you can. I've got a feeling this isn't going to be a deadly serious suggestion, Ian. But prove me wrong.
It is actually a deadly serious. Now, do you remember when Richie did that eat out to dine out or whatever? Right. This was during like a COVID thing, social distancing. Right. I know the place where I worked, daytimes DJing, they've never had it so good as that. Because
during that period.
Like,
daytime DJing must be a bit of a trip.
No. It's the way forward.
It
was difficult because people weren't allowed to dance, but social distancing, forget it. But, like, I just make the point. What they need to do, you need to speak to Rachel Reeves, get her to cut. I haven't done the figures, the math.
Oh, don't worry about it. Not did Rishi Sunak.
Like, cut duty on, you know, on... Yeah,
but why?
Listen.
I can't listen. I've got the news to go to. You're taking ages. Right. Spit it out.
Cut the duty on alcohol in pubs and quadruple, triple the duty on alcohol in supermarkets. Therefore, people will think, I have to go out if I need a drink.
You make an interesting suggestion. And in fact, the first thing that the pub industry should do is sign up a Tufton Street lobby group. Masquerading as a think tank. They could do some secret donations. They seem very popular at the moment. Not naming any names, Nigel. But, and get them to lobby government in order to protect the pub industry to the detriment, quite possibly, of the customers. But nonetheless, it would be to the benefit of the pub owners. This one, I think, would be, I don't know. But what gap does it leave is the crucial question, isn't it? What hole does it leave in a community? And that idea of a pub. It's a third space as well. It's a great point made by Kev. I shall share that with you a little further in a moment. And as Tim points out, or at least as he asks, is the Lawnswood Arms or the Market Tavern still open? Now, why does that demonstrate a particular level of attention to this radio programme and this radio presenter? Answer... They're both pubs that were at various times in the dim and distant past run by my late grandmother, and neither of them exist anymore. The Market Tavern, I don't think the building is even there. And the Lawnswood Arms, I'm delighted to tell you, is now a Hickory's Smokehouse, offering authentic Southern-style barbecue, a dedicated kids' menu, and a sports bar, along with dog-friendly spaces. So would that have counted as a pub closure? When it went from being a pub to being a kind of themed restaurant. I honestly don't know. 11:30 is the time. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
The Prime Minister says attempts by Iran to destabilise British society won't be tolerated at the start of a summit on tackling anti-Semitism. Sir Keir Starmer's told the meeting this morning that police are looking into whether a foreign state are behind some of the attacks on the Jewish community. Counter-terror police are investigating a suspected arson attack at a former synagogue in East London. The fire broke out at a building in Tower Hamlets early this morning. No injuries have been reported. And the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament has warned the US that we're just getting started following clashes in the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump's so-called Operation Freedom aims to ensure that commercial ships can use the vital oil route. LBC weather, sunshine and showers. For large parts of the UK through today, some light rain in the north, wintry showers on higher ground for northern Scotland, a high of 18 degrees.
This is LBC.
Fevertree Ginger Beer. There's no one quite like you, is there? That fiery character, warming undertones. Mixed, you make a spirited Moscow Mule. But even on your own, you still have the most delectable kick. Fevertree. Straight up or mixed. It's a matter of taste.
Donations to British Heart Foundation fund scientific research that can help save lives. People like Joe, who's pitching his next big business plan. Maria, who's sending out her wedding invitations. And Jack, who's just being a teenager again. Because when you donate, you fund more than just science. You help save lives. British Heart Foundation funds research that aims to cure inherited heart muscle diseases. But our work is not done. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Ready for a new kitchen? Wickes Kitchen Experts can support you with clever designs and a professional installation. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wickes.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. Saga Travel Insurance covers most pre-existing medical conditions and has been named a Which Best Buy. Smart choice. And right now, you can get 20% off travel insurance until the 11th of June. Search Saga Travel Insurance for a quote today. New policies only, subject to medical screening. Standard and Plus are Which Best Buys May 2025. Terms and conditions apply. Over 50s only.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the journalism industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Molly, a journalism student in year 12.
Outside of the classroom, we run our own news platform called The Loop. I do a daily news bulletin and produce videos for socials. We learn everything we need to be a journalist and have even learned alongside the news team at Global.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. globalacademy.com.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It's 33 minutes after 11. I wonder whether I was a little bit, what would the word be? A little bit cowardly at the top of this hour. Now, the question I'm really asking is whether or not the closure of pubs in its current form is something we should all be mourning. It's presented to us as a national tragedy. And, of course, if it's in certain newspapers, it will be presented to us as all Rachel Reeves' fault or Keir Starmer's fault or possibly Gary Lineker's. But actually, that's the question, isn't it? It took me a while to get there. But the question is whether or not this is actually a tragedy. A few of you pointing out that alcoholism and the rest of it are going to be affected by the ease of access to alcohol. And even if you're not an alcoholic, but you're not doing your health any good by popping in for a couple of sharpeners on your way home every evening. I mean, there's quite a lot of argument for saying that the closure of pubs is quite a good thing. With the constant caveat, of course, that that's terrible if you're working in one or running one or indeed living above one. But is it really a national tragedy? Or is it something that represents both social change and quite possibly a change for good? 11:34 is the time. Matthew's in Redhill. Matthew, what would you like to say?
Good morning, James.
Matthew.
Yes, I think this whole subject of communities having somewhere to go and be together and discuss ideas is critical to so much of what you talk about. The footballification of society would perhaps be diluted if more people spent time with their neighbours.
It does seem to me that there were always way more pub bores than we realised when they were confined to being pub bores, because they'd get laughed down or they'd get teased out of their pompous position or they'd get punched, whereas now they spend all of their time on social media surrounded by other pub bores and they're taking over, Matthew. They're taking over the world.
They are, absolutely. And even the people who aren't a pub bore, they are choosing to sit at home, or maybe they're not choosing, maybe their local pub is closed and therefore they're stuck in their own house with their own mobile phones, cheap wine that they've got from the supermarket, and they're not meeting anyone else.
And having their carefully cultivated positions and prejudices challenged in any way, shape or form. I mean, that's one thing that we could mourn the passing of, but I mean, are we really looking at a national tragedy, or is there? I just can't help thinking that if it was something else that was shutting, like betting shops, we wouldn't all be sitting here going, "Oh, this is terrible! All the betting shops are shutting." And there's probably more of a parallel between a pub and a betting shop than there is between a pub and a greengrocer.
I don't know, because I don't think you would spend much time in a greengrocer chatting.
I did once, so my mate had a greengrocer's nearby, but he's moved to Chelsea now, so I hardly ever see him. But no, you're right, the greengrocer is not exactly a social hub. But you don't need alcohol to socialise. I mean, the third space is what Kev described. You're talking about the third place, home, work, and then a third place, whether it's a pub or a library or a church. I mean, you wouldn't do much socialising in a library either, but somewhere where you could go and interact in real life with fellow flesh and fellow blood, that is what we're seeing the disappearance of, which is where your social media point comes in.
And also, if I may make a point, my local pub briefly closed, and suddenly the community realised what it had lost. And a few spirited individuals rallied together and managed to reopen it. And it's been, I think people have, now that they realise what it was like not to have it, they've come back in their droves, and there's now a book club, a craft club, there's musicians meeting there. The pub is doing a great trade. It's not charging £10 a pint. It's more like a fiver. And I just feel like, because we had it taken away from us and then we got it back, it made a massive difference.
Yes, and it would be obeying different imperatives as well. If you're going to be, if you like, ramping up the community element, then you'll be ramping down the commercial element. So when people club together to buy a local pub that's closed, they're not going to be enslaved by the profit imperatives of the big pub companies, are they? They're going to be able to run it for different reasons and for different people, if you like. I guess a coffee shop has come back round again. You go back to the times of Charles Dickens. coffee shops would have been a big challenge to the pubs. It would have been one or the other that you would go to for a socialise. In fact, I think, and I haven't got the history to state this with absolute certainty, but the coffee shops would have been a more civilised place for socialising as opposed to the pubs. It's certainly around Fleet Street and places like that, going back beyond before Dickens, coffee shops are absolutely crucial. Salons, if you like, of interaction and discussion. Probably a bit easier to do it in a coffee shop than it would be in a pub. It depends how many cups you've had. And then the Quakers came along and brought out the chocolate, so you'd have hot chocolate, but you could still socialise. You don't need the alcohol, the lubricant of socialisation. You don't need the alcohol to have the socialisation. But as Kev points out, they're shutting all the third places. And not for commercial reasons. Churches didn't shut because they weren't making money. Well, I suppose in a way they did. But you don't think of them as a commercial enterprise. Thank you, Matthew. Danny's in Harlow. Danny, what do you think?
I reckon it's more a case of social engineering.
Go on.
Point. Well, by making pubs too expensive, you're forcing people into supermarkets where alcohol's cheap.
Mm.
Once they've been to the supermarket, they go home, where they have no other entertainment but to stare at a television that's feeding them propaganda or looking at social media that is polarising whatever idea they may have at that time.
They might be watching the football or EastEnders, but I take your point. The exposure, I mean, the algorithms were designed to suck us in, chew us up and never, ever spit us out, aren't they? So
yeah,
the pub would have been almost a sort of challenge to that model.
Yeah, and when you consider that most of the working class movements and movements of the 1800s were either started in, as you say, coffee shops or in pubs, it's almost like, you know, they're guiding us towards the information that they want us to know about. And by taking out that social interaction, that discussion, people's ideals and ideas have become so polarised because there isn't that level playing field, that one place where you can go to discuss ideas, whether you're right or wrong. You learn stuff at pubs. I never drank. I'm not a heavy drinker, not really. I probably drink at Christmas. So when I used to go to my pub, where all my mates used to go in Stortford, the Tanner's Arms, I used to go in there and make myself a cup of tea, sit down. It wasn't because of the alcohol. It was because it was a place of like-minded people where you felt safe to discuss the issues that you're not allowed to talk about.
Where would you go now? Nowhere?
I don't go anywhere.
Oh, that's sad.
No, instead I just harass people like you and politicians. So it's good fun.
I suppose we serve a purpose then. We've got a form of sort of community group or social group on here,
yeah.
but it's not the same, is it? A start, no one would be allowed to lay down the law and dominate the conversation in a pub as much as I do on this
program.
Well,
no, as I say, the other side effect to drinking at home is the possible rise in domestic violence due to alcohol.
I don't know about that. I think you'd be just as likely to come home from the pub in a state of anger and violence as you would be necessarily to reach it. But I know that the incidents do go up when there's international football on, and that would obviously usually involve alcohol consumption as well. How do we know, though, Danny, that we're not, like, just sort of mourning the seasons? Do you know what I mean? That these things come. I like your analysis, but it's knocking at the door of a conspiracy theory that this has been deliberately inflicted upon us to stop us from communing and conversing and sticking it to the man and recognizing oligarchy. I mean, it's possible, but for me, it's unlikely. It could just be that we're changing our habits. Here you go. This is from Laura. Why are we mourning this? Every day meeting at the pub, anyone under the age of 35 has no great love for dark, smelly places where you can only order beer and bad wine. Many people over 35 would probably rather go anywhere else, to a cafe or a restaurant or even somebody's house.
Again, I've forgotten what I was going to say now.
That's
I was
right.
listening to you.
Happens to me all the time, mate. 11:42 is the time. Greg is in Penmaco in Wales. Penmacno. No, he's not. He's gone. So there's no Penmacno. There you go. See if Danny's come back. Danny, has it come back to you?
No.
Oh, well. Joe's in Enniskillen. Joe, what would you like to say?
Hello, James.
That's all right.
Let me take you back a few years. I'm a little bit older than you.
Yeah.
And I grew up in similar size of area.
Right.
I grew up in social clubs. My dad was on the committee. My mum played for the darts team from the age of probably 3 until I was about 30. I was in a social club every day. So that was one, the heart of the community. But then pubs, it was pub sports. Like you had darts teams, snooker teams, whist. They used to go from pub to another pub, could be 3 miles away, spend the whole evening with a whole different group of people.
But not that many people were in the teams. Regulars didn't travel, did they? So there'd only be four of you in the darts team.
This was like, you know, community-wise.
All right.
This would be the 80s. There were teams of eight.
Okay.
And two teams in each pub.
Ladies and gents.
It's just stopping assimilation of our community. It's like the previous two guys said very well.
I hadn't thought of it this way around. I mean, the idea that we're becoming more atomised as a consequence of third spaces closing and the pubs would be the biggest. I suppose it actually makes perfect sense. I wouldn't go so far as the last lad and claim that it has been done deliberately from on high. It's just an unfortunate consequence of something that was happening anyway.
No, I think I tilt.
When did you last have a conversation with someone that you didn't know previously? Apart from me,
I do it every single day.
Oh,
but
do
that's because I work with people.
Oh well, no, I don't mean that. That's at work. Because I'm at work. If you're not at work, you're literally in a space that is not your home or your work, and you have a conversation with somebody new. When was the last time you did that?
Every single day, because I live in Northern Ireland.
Oh, I see.
I do now.
It's like Mum in Yorkshire. It really is. I mean, that is what some people do. They can have conversations, but that's just ships that pass in the night. You're not going to sit down and actually set the world to rights together, are you? Oh, blimey, there's a lot here. But that idea of it not necessarily being the national tragedy. When I started this job, I would look at newspapers and recognise that the agenda was set by people who were 20 years older than me and mostly looked like me. Some of them had been educated like me. That's not true anymore because I'm getting on a bit, relatively speaking. But I think some things are legacy. So pubs closing, bad. Whereas most people, as Laura pointed out, certainly people under 35 will not be thinking that. They'll be thinking something quite different. It's 11:45. Simon Marks is up after this.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
You know how importantly we deal with the issue of online safety here at LBC. I've been privileged to speak with Ellen Room. I remind you, she lost her 14-year-old son. Although it's for all the wrong reasons, it's good to see you now at last in the studio. Ellen, thank you for coming by. And joining you is a fellow campaigner, Lauren Cowell. I remember speaking one time when you were at number 10 Downing Street, and I was struck by the fact that the Prime Minister declined to meet you.
I really want to get our stories across. As a group of bereaved parents, we've got a whole range of stories about whether the children were groomed online, whether they've dealt with a challenge, and just actually, these are real children. This is really happening.
Lauren, what do you make of the fact that the PM hasn't met with your friend and others?
It is very disappointing. I mean, that's putting it mildly. I think they deserve to be heard.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
At John Lewis Money, we know your home is more than an address. It's the sunlight pouring in. Well, sometimes. The coffee on tap, and the best spot on the sofa. It's why our home insurance is thoughtfully designed with 3 levels of flexible cover for the home you've created. Because when you notice the details, you notice the difference. Search John Lewis Money. Terms and exclusions apply. John Lewis Finance Limited is authorised for insurance distribution and credit broking by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1 or via post. Enter by midnight on Sunday and your special day could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus, UK only, no purchase necessary.
Now with Lidl Plus, collect points that you can turn into possibilities. Pepper abilities, pasta abilities, burrata abilities, kayak abilities. so collect and spend your Lidl Plus points on hundreds of rewards or money off coupons. Lidl, more to value. Exclusions apply. For T's and C's, lidl.co.uk/LPTV 18 plus GB only.
How likely is she to, you know, have another heart attack?
Can I still go to the gym after heart surgery?
Is my mum still my mum if she has a new heart?
When it comes to heart health, no question is too big or small. That's why British Heart Foundation have dedicated cardiac nurses you can speak to by phone, email, or online chat.
Hi, this is Chloe from British Heart Foundation. How can I help?
Search BHF Cardiac Nurses.
At Wix, the Home and Garden event is now on. Save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £24, now £16. Ends Wednesday. Terms apply.
Leading Britain's conversation. LBC with James O'Brien.
It's 11:49. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Conversation in the first hour had some echoes of what we have seen unfold in the United States of America, and I think one of the least controversial things I can say on this program is that we have been able to navigate all of the things, or most of the things, going on in the United States of America with expert guidance, thanks to Simon Marks's status as our LBC Washington correspondent. And lo and behold, here he is again. Is it open? Is it closed? Is it closed but a bit open? Is it open but a bit closed? Are Iran right? Is Trump right? Is it all going well? Is the war over? Has the war been won? Is Iran desperate? Morning.
Well, we're certainly no further forward, and good morning to you, James. We're certainly no further forward, and we are arguably several steps back. And what we've seen over the last 48 hours is just more chaos arising from Donald Trump's sudden announcement on Sunday on social media of this new initiative, what he's calling Project Freedom, which he couched in his initial announcement as a humanitarian effort to try and alleviate suffering on board tankers that are basically stuck, either waiting to sail through the Strait of Hormuz or sail up the Strait of Hormuz, but they're basically stuck at sea. They're running out of food on board. They're running out of water in many cases. And according to the president, increasingly unsanitary conditions are developing on some ships that pose, he says, a health threat to crews. And to be absolutely clear about the way he positioned this, he said that this was an effort to help tankers associated with countries that were uninvolved in the conflict, not American ones, not Iranian ones, tankers particularly from Middle Eastern countries and other parts of the world that had simply found themselves in this very difficult position. And so the US Navy in some fashion was going to get them through the strait. Well, all of that caused a significant number of questions that the White House then scrambled to answer. And within hours, the White House was putting a clarification out saying the president did not mean to indicate that the United States Navy, which is, of course, blockading the Strait of Hormuz, was going to start leading these ships through the strait. This wasn't about breaking the blockade. This was about providing those ships that wanted to try and alleviate the humanitarian problems they're facing with guidance on how they themselves could successfully navigate the strait. Presumably, wow, you know, getting on a radio and saying these are the point bearings that you need to follow if you want to avoid known risks. Mm. But it wasn't about anything other than that. So, then, of course, yesterday... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Sorry.
Well, so then, of course, yesterday, all hell broke loose because the Iranians smelt a rat and thought that this was all an effort by the United States to break the blockade. They claimed to have lobbed two missiles that they said had hit a U.S. warship that then retreated. Central Command denied it, said that no U.S. warship had been hit, although didn't say whether a U.S. warship had been targeted, and also didn't comment on claims that the Iranians had made that the warship had turned around and retreated after coming under attack. And then suddenly we learnt that Central Command was announcing that they had successfully guided two ships through the Strait of Hormuz, both of them US flagged, which of course was not what Project Freedom was supposed to be all about. The Americans then said that they'd struck seven or eight Iranian fast boats that were in the water. I mean, so this idea that was first promulgated on social media by the president suddenly becomes the ignition point for a possible end to the ceasefire that, let me remind you, he himself has cited in letters to Congress, where he has explained to lawmakers why he doesn't need to seek congressional authorization for his war, because he claims, well, the war's over. Hostilities terminated on April the 7th when the ceasefire began. So this sort of blundering about has once again brought the Iran crisis to boiling point, with every possibility, after certainly one tanker, a UAE vessel, did get struck by Iranian fire yesterday, that this tinderbox once again gets reignited.
Our another esteemed correspondent that we have on the program is an ex-merchant navy officer who now teaches maritime matters and creates online courses, Ash in Northampton, and he kind of predicted a couple of the things that have happened and are happening, up to and including the fact that the only people who can absolutely guarantee safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz will always be the people that put the mines there in the first place. He also alerted me to the plight of the sailors stuck on the ships, who've been completely overlooked until you mentioned them a moment ago. And this has never happened before, but I'm possibly more confused when you finish talking than I was when you started talking. But there's a first time for everything. Well, hang on. Are they still there? I mean, the ships that are supposedly the beneficiaries of the policy, are because their plight is so terrible, they haven't moved an inch.
Well, not so far, no. Other than the two US-flagged vessels
who were not part
guided
of the, who were not part
the
of the original proposal.
Who were not part of the mission.
No, I do understand
correct.
It. I take it all back. Holy moly. And does any of it matter? This is a question I ask you almost every time we talk. Is any of this resonating anywhere important or relevant or significant?
Well, I think it is. I think it matters on Capitol Hill, increasingly. I mean, with every passing day, we get 24 hours closer to the midterm elections. And with every passing day, Republican lawmakers who are up for re-election, or those in various parts of the country running for election for the first time, are getting increasingly antsy. Not just about the direction of the war in Iran, but about the economic consequences of this. Donald Trump again yesterday breezily suggesting that petrol prices are going to drop, they're going to sink like a stone as soon as this conflict is over. That runs entirely counter to testimony and classified briefings that Pentagon officials have provided to lawmakers who say that even if peace was agreed today, it would take up to 6 months fully to be certain that the Strait of Hormuz was cleared of mines. So this is not going to be like a tap. You don't, you know, turn it off and everything suddenly returns to normal the moment you agree peace with Iran. And this government, the US government, appears to be almost uniquely unable to strike a peace agreement with the Iranians because of the nature of those people engaged from the American side in the negotiations. There's still no one from the American side that is steeped in the complexities of the nuclear issue. Mm. I mean, you've got Steve Witkoff, the president's old real estate mucker, man he met in a deli at 2 o'clock in the morning in New York and once bought a sandwich for, and then they became firm mates. You've got Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who spends half his time trying to gild his own lily by securing investment deals from the Saudis and other players in the region. You've got Marco Rubio, maybe not involved, very unclear. He's briefing the press here later today. We might get a fresh sense of where things are going. They're all kind of, you know, they're sort of gentlemen amateurs in all of this. The Iranians have got years and years of experience of negotiating with Western powers over the very issue that Donald Trump says is his red line, the nuclear issue. Yeah. And it's far from clear the Americans have got anyone on their team able to match the specialization that the Iranians can deliver in any talks that may or may now not be taking place.
All of which explains why it was greeted with such relief and joy when it was actually signed back in 2015 by members of a previous administration, something William Hague writes rather powerfully about in the Times today. On we go. You spotted this, I know you did, the Financial Times reporting on the tariffs, almost to continue a theme, Simon, having precisely the opposite effect from the one that Donald Trump predicted they would have when he introduced them.
Yeah, I was really startled by this a few days ago. It was sort of tucked away in a corner of the Financial Times. But there are new numbers out about the UK's trading relationship with the United States. And if you remember last April, the Liberation Day tariffs, we were all very hurt by because we argued, and indeed the Trump administration accepted, that US-UK trade was basically in balance. We weren't running a massive trading deficit. We were sending them pretty much what they were sending us. There was a bit of dispute around the edges, but we were way ahead of many of the other countries that were being seriously penalized by the Trump administration. We then fast-forwarded to the UK-US economic prosperity deal with Lord Mandelson smiling like a Cheshire cat in the Oval Office as Keir Starmer called on the phone to herald this as a major turning point in the relationship. If you actually look at the numbers, since April of 2025, Liberation Day, through until February of 2026, suddenly there's a trading deficit. UK goods exports to the US averaged $4.7 billion a month, down from their previous average of $5.5 billion a month. So what Donald Trump has managed to do is actually create between the UK and the US the very thing that his Liberation Day tariffs were designed to try and overcome. Trading, of course, they could never overcome it, because if you're a tiny country like Swaziland, you're never going to be able to export as much to the United States as you buy from the United States. But if the goal of all of this was to eliminate trading deficits, well, in the case of the UK, it's completely backfired because, as the FT reported, there are UK manufacturers that have just got so fed up with dealing with the unpredictability of the Trump administration. They've said, let's go to other markets. Let's sell to Hong Kong. Let's sell to Germany. Let's sell to India. Let's sell elsewhere. So it's an astonishing own goal for the US economy and for US consumers. But it's also a problem for the UK because it means we're selling less across the Atlantic to our major trading partner. Just another example of the chaos that Donald Trump has wrought here, but also there.
Well, you lob a rock in a pond and you don't get to control where the ripples go. We're out of time, so we can't talk about Eric Trump, which frankly is a relief.
Don Jr.
Thank you. Oh, was it Don Jr.? It wasn't Eric. Next time we'll catch up. We can't talk about either of them. Such is the nature of the passage of time. Simon Marks, live from Washington. It's 12:01.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the Prime Minister says attempts by Iran to destabilise British society won't be tolerated at a summit to tackle anti-Semitism. Sir Keir Starmer has brought together leaders from across public life, including education, health and the arts. He's told the meeting that the targeting of the Jewish community has turned the issue into a crisis. Speaking from Downing Street, Sir Keir said police are looking into whether a foreign state are behind some of the recent attacks.
Our message to Iran or to any other country that might seek to foment violence, hatred or division in society is that it will not be tolerated. That is why we're fast-tracking legislation to tackle these malign threats.
Counter-terror police are investigating a suspected arson attack at a former synagogue in East London. The fire broke out at a building in Tower Hamlets early this morning. No injuries have been reported. The Speaker of the Iranian Parliament has warned the United States that we're just getting started following clashes in the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump's so-called Operation Freedom aims to ensure that commercial ships can use the vital oil route. Tehran has effectively blockaded the key trading shipment lane during the two-month conflict. Ross Harrison is a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. He's told LBC it's a dangerous moment.
What we're seeing here is that Donald Trump is in what we call an escalation trap, in that he can't really achieve the objectives that he wants, which is capitulation on the part of the Iranians, by escalating. And he can't de-escalate lest he admit defeat or some kind of falling short of his war objective. And the Iranians, on the other hand, have very little to lose by escalating than de-escalating.
A British crew member is said to be in need of urgent medical care after developing symptoms of a rare rat-borne virus on a cruise ship. Three people have died following the outbreak of hantavirus on the vessel, which is currently in the Atlantic Ocean. A passenger from the UK remains in a critical but stable condition after being airlifted to hospital in South Africa. And a record number of people have applied to take part in next year's London Marathon. More than 1.3 million names will go into the draw for places. It's more than double the total number who applied 2 years ago. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 were trading down 100 points at 10,263. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather, sunshine and showers for large parts of the UK, some light rain in northern England, wintry showers possible on higher ground in northern Scotland, a high of 18 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. All wobbly, all wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
There are two stories in the news today that turn your head somewhat and raise your eyebrows, and then you remember that although they are absolutely remarkable stories, they are human stories as well. So they don't lend themselves to unseriousness, is probably the word that I'm looking for. There's one particularly grisly tale of a hotelier in South Africa who was found inside the belly of a crocodile. It's an extraordinary, I can't say rescue, obviously, but they needed to extract the crocodile from there's no other way of saying this, from a crocodile-infested island, and they did so by hitting it with a dart, lowering someone down, and then tying the crocodile up and lifting it all back out again on a helicopter. And then when they opened up the crocodile, they found the missing hotelier. And I thought that had an extraordinary level of interest in it, but I noticed myself a couple of seconds into contemplating the story and wondering whether we would talk about it. It's a human story. It's about a person. It's about someone's dad. It's about, you know, a huge, you know what I mean, about how sometimes the humanity can be overshadowed by the extraordinary nature of the context. Happens a lot. And I don't want it to happen in the conversation that we're having next, because three people, as you just heard in the news, are dead. But it struck me, and this is something of a conversation that Mrs. O'Brien and I have on an ongoing basis. The only time you ever hear about cruises is when something bad happens. I mean, in many ways, the only time you ever hear about anything is when something bad happens. It's you know, the nature of news reporting, I suppose. It's like that. I got it wrong the other day when I said it was, who did I say it was? The Fast Show. It's from the Day to Day, I think. It was it a Steve Coogan character playing the lifeguard in the swimming pool. 1988, nobody drowned. In 1999, nobody drowned. He's trying to justify or in his mind, the unfair amounts of attention that are paid to the fact that someone drowned on his watch in 1 year. So he lists all the other years where that never happened. Have I told you my equivalent story? I'll just tell you very, very briefly. I must have told you this before. Keith will nod if he knows. Do you know the one about when I went to visit the illegal travellers encampment in Essex? Do you know this one? So I went to visit this illegal travellers encampment in Essex because a 16-year-old girl rang in to the programme to talk to us about what life was like actually on it, while the rest of the media was raging and raving about how they should all be burnt out of their homes or removed from the planet entirely. And I was just, again, struck by her humanity. So I did something I don't really do anymore. I arranged to go and visit. I don't really like leaving the studio. It was bad enough doing it from a shed during lockdown. So I visited, and we drove down there, me and the producer that I had at the time. We drove down there, and it was an absolute experience. There's no doubt about that. And it was an extraordinary piece of radio. Unfortunately, this was back when nobody actually listened to this programme, and we certainly didn't have cameras in the studio, or indeed a reliable habit of scoring what the kids call viral clips. So you won't be aware of this unless you happen to be listening to the radio on that day. Because about 3 months later, we were assembling our forces to enter the awards that we used to enter. And I said to the producer of the programme, I said, oh, we must put that in for an award. I've never heard anybody do that before. And he looked at me slightly askance. And he went, ah, I've lost it. I said, what? He said, I've lost it. I said, you've lost it. How can you lose it? He goes, well, everything's on tape. And I mean, this can't have been, there must have been a digital archive, but I think would it refresh or it would erase itself? Unless you specifically and deliberately, so we're going back 20 years, give or take, you specifically and deliberately archived something to save it for, you know, a rainy day or for posterity, everything would get wiped over. Like CCTV, if you like. You know, if you don't get there in time, then it's going to have gone back to the beginning of the tape and started again. I know it's all digital now, but it wasn't then. That's how old I am. And I got quite aerated. Is it aerated or aerated? It's aerated. I don't know. I got quite cross. Why do I always have to use three syllables where one will do? I got quite cross. And I said, you can't. I mean, it's the best thing I've ever done on the radio, which was a slight exaggeration, but only slight. What do you mean? And he did that thing. He literally said, well, it's the only thing I've lost this year. I said, it's the best thing we've done this year. Yes, it's the only thing I've lost. On Monday, I didn't lose anything. On Tuesday, I didn't lose anything. On Wednesday, but on the day that we actually, you know, did some proper journalism, we lost it. So that was my equivalent of this. I do like that story as well. Thomas reminds us the captain of the Titanic, had he survived, would have said, no one ever talks about the icebergs you didn't hit. So I mention all of this because the only time you ever read about cruises or learn about cruises or cruises ever make the news is when something terrible is happening. And something terrible is currently happening. There are more than 20 Britons, including a sick crew member, stranded on a cruise ship at the moment at the centre of a suspected rodent-borne virus outbreak that has already left one British citizen in intensive care and three others dead, a Dutch husband and wife and a German. The ship is not allowed to dock at the moment, just off Cape Verde, so presumably it is under their jurisdiction. And the tour company has said that one crew member, it's only a 35-day voyage, but they are well, seriously ill. I think since we've come on air, they've arranged to airlift two people off the ship, but the ship is not allowed to dock. And here's the thing, right? This is not going to be one of our big, serious, heavy-duty phone-ins. I have always fancied going on a cruise. I've got this, what would the word be? I've got a slightly romantic image of a cruise, of the ocean waves sort of lulling me to sleep at night and arriving at somewhere exciting and not having to run the risk of being bored because I've got to leave again that evening. Do you see, I've always, everything I like about the idea of a cruise, Mrs. O'Brien doesn't like. So we have an incredibly harmonious marriage, so much so that we very recently celebrated our 26th wedding anniversary, would you believe? And yet the one thing I don't think we'll ever do that I would like to do is go on a cruise. And part of the reason for this is the fact that whenever they are in the news, it is because something terrible is happening. There aren't many worse sort of intros to a story than a suspected rodent-borne virus outbreak that has already left one British citizen in intensive care. But I've got friends that have been on cruises. Some of my mum's friends go on cruises. And yet, I can't, what's the word that I want? There's a fear on my part. You can't change your mind when you're on a cruise, can you? Well, you can't sort of have a bit of a rethink or stay somewhere else or cash your chips in and change location. I simply want to have a chat today about whether or not they are Marmite. Whether or not a cruise, because what I really want to do is talk to people who went on a cruise and hated it. I want to get to the bottom of whether or not the things that appeal to some people repel other people, and the things that repel some people appeal to other people. It's a really odd way to holiday if you've never done it. You know what I mean? So you go, you might hire an apartment, or you might stay in a hotel, but you don't go anywhere when you go on a cruise. You kind of go everywhere. You don't have a location. Where are you going? I'm going on a cruise. Where are you going? I'm going to the Caribbean, and I'm going here, and I'm going... But where are you going on holiday? I'm going on a ship. So your ship is your holiday. The ship... Do you see what I mean? Somewhere inside me, I can see the appeal, but that's my heart. My head struggles. The more thinking I do... And this is where Mrs. O'Brien is, as is so often the case, way ahead of me, because she's doing the thinking and I'm doing the feeling. The more thinking I do, the more mad it seems as a holiday plan. So I just want to know the truth. Is it good or is it bad? 03456060973. And you say this, look, here it goes. You could get off at the first stop and then fly home. They're not allowed to dock, Alyssa, at the moment. They've got a rodent-borne virus sweeping through the ship, and they're not allowed... So I'd live with that fear. I'd live with that fear, and there's always stories, and they're probably massively unrepresentative. I'm sure there's 1,000 successful cruises for everyone that makes the newspaper, because every single person on the vessel is puking. But there's something quite... Maybe it's because I went to boarding school. There's something, I don't know what it is that I'm trying to pin down, but I do know that you can help me pin it down. So, cruises. Should stories like this act as a valid deterrent to put the rest of us from even contemplating such a strange way of spending a few weeks? 03456060973. Or are they actually the exceptions that prove the rule? It's only because they are usually such wonderful and happy experiences that we get the coverage that we get when something terrible like this happens. I just want to know. Either give me what I need to persuade Mrs. O'Brien to do one, as in to go on a cruise with me, not to actually do one, or confirm her suspicions that you can tell I'm tying myself in knots. All right, I'm going to say it. Are they holidays for a very specific sort of person? 03456060973 is the number that you need. Or would everyone enjoy one? There's a sort of type that likes a cruise because, you know, they don't... It's a bit package... 03456060973, please.
This is LBC.
How likely is she to, have another heart attack?
Can I still go to the gym after heart surgery?
Is my mum still my mum if she has a new heart?
When it comes to heart health, no question is too big or small. That's why British Heart Foundation have dedicated cardiac nurses you can speak to by phone, email or online chat.
Hi, this is Chloe from British Heart Foundation. How can I help?
Search BHF Cardiac Nurses.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2025 Amazon packaging data across the UK and EU.
You've packed enough suitcases to know quality when you see it. Well, Saga Travel Insurance has been named a Which Best Buy. And now get 20% off when you buy before the 11th of June. Search Saga Travel Insurance for a quote today. New policies only, standard and plus are Which Best Buys May 2025. Terms and conditions apply, over 50s only.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
It's 12:17, and there's some other things now. Some coming through my inbox and some bubbling their way up to the top of my own consciousness. The thing that I have a problem with is what I've witnessed when I'm having a very nice holiday somewhere like Venice or Santorini. And then the cruise ship arrives, and it decants these Americans who, right, they're like locusts. So Venice in particular, I think they've made measures now, haven't they, to contain the horror? The horror. But Santorini as well, which is one of the most beautiful places you could ever dream of visiting. And then these people land, and they're like locusts in the sense that they just need to do, they need to tick that box and buy that thing and absorb that experience and photograph that view. And it's almost as if, I'll tell you what it is, it's like Pokemon Go was a holiday. They're just sucking up a preordained list of experiences and sights. And we must go to that restaurant and eat that ice cream. And I don't know. I holiday in a very different way. I could find myself staring at a beautiful view for days. All right, not days. But you can't. Anyway, good or bad? Yes or no? Is it a certain type of person? Or a certain. Yeah. Lorraine's in Littlehampton. Lorraine, what would you like to say?
Yes, I booked a world cruise back in 2020.
Well, shouldn't you have had a taster first?
Oh, I had.
Oh, good. Go on.
But I, because my partner won't travel, so I thought I'd go and see everything in one hit.
Right.
And then COVID came about.
Yeah.
And we're heading towards China after going around New Zealand. And my partner saying...
How much of China are you likely to see on a cruise? On a world cruise?
You could go to different places. You could go to excursions and pay the extra to travel to.
So, like, for 3 hours?
Terracotta Army.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, because of COVID and hearing that the cruise ships were being kept in Japan and China
I remember that.
So I jumped ship in Australia and flew to Sri Lanka, waiting for the boat to pick me up, so I thought.
Right.
And then the world closed down. And I managed
A slightly rarefied experience, Lorraine. I don't know that it's going to push me away from or towards cruising as a choice, as a holiday choice.
You can get off the ship.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
Yeah, because I paid for the cabin, so I jumped... I went to Sri Lanka waiting for the boat, and it never happened. But I got back to London just before lockdown, and all my friends on the cruise ship had to sail around for a good few weeks without stopping anywhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not a once-in-a-lifetime experience, is it? This idea that that something bad happens on a ship and nobody wants it to dock anywhere near them. Would that underpin your whole experience? Can I ask you a very un-British... Oh, I think she's dropped off the line. Can we get her back? Because there's one crucial question that I want to ask her. I mean, a world cruise. Is that like the best thing you've ever heard or the worst? Because I can see both angles of world cruise. It's like she said, she's going to be able to see everything. She's going to see the Eiffel Tower, Statue of Liberty, Terracotta Army. How long was it scheduled to take, Lorraine?
It was about 2.5 months altogether.
The whole world?
Yes.
in 10 weeks?
Well, could have been more than that.
And here's the question. Okay, how much was it cost, full work?
I can't remember now, but I did get a refund.
No, but how much was it roughly? Ballpark. Come on, Lorraine, don't be coy.
Oh, about 22.
Oh, okay. I thought it might have been...
Wasn't too bad.
And would you go on another one?
No.
No, I don't blame you. I don't know what that story does in terms of my pendulum. It's curiously inert at the moment. Thank you, Lorraine. It's nice to have you back. Paul's in New Southgate. Paul, what would you like to say?
Hello there. Yeah, I was someone sceptical. I didn't fancy cruising. It was for old people, even though I'm kind of pushing 68, so old. But last year, we decided we'd never been on a cruise and we'd never done Japan before. Oh. And we thought, what a good way to do Japan, because that way you're not unpacking and repacking. You leave your room at 8 o'clock in the morning when you've docked after breakfast. You either go on your own trip that you can organise yourself. Well, like you go somewhere like Tokyo, you're going to see different things. Osaka was amazing.
How many ports did you port in? Did you dock in?
We did, it was 13 days. We did about 8, including one day in South Korea.
That's insane. And how did you get to Japan? Did you fly to Japan and then get on the boat? You didn't sail to Japan.
It was a whole sort of trip.
So here's the thing, right? Don't tell me yet whether you look back on it fondly or negatively. What happens if, on day one, you go somewhere amazing, right, and you think, flipping out, I could spend a fortnight here, it's fantastic. And then on day two, you go somewhere a bit mediocre, and you realise that you're going to have to book another holiday to see the first place properly, and the second place didn't float your boat at all, if you pardon the pun, Paul.
But no, but that's the thing. I mean, every day was good. There was probably one slightly boring stop-off. But the thing is, it is an introduction to a country, and doing it that way, it was a good way to do it.
Is it? Are you sure, Paul? Because it sounds a little bit... I don't know what the word is. It sounds a little bit like the holiday equivalent of ultra-processed food.
No, because you actually, I mean, if you go to the talks beforehand, they say, this is what you're going to see. You can either book a slightly overpriced trip with us, or you can just go and jump.
Make your own way. Okay, so you'd do another one, would you? I think we've got his gone as well. I don't know what's going on. They're all falling. John's in Northampton. John, what can you tell me?
We did our first cruise after sort of deliberating for about 30 years, shall we, shan't we?
Yeah, that's where I am at the moment. I'm about 15 years into that process.
Right, was our 50th last year.
Oh, congratulations.
So did a week as a taster in the Mediterranean, sort of the Adriatic area.
Very nice.
And if you're the type of person that doesn't like discipline, you like to do what you want to do on a holiday.
Yeah, man, that's me. I'm basically a maverick. I'm a maverick.
Yeah, I know you go to Greece a lot, but so the thing is, you have to be up about 5 o'clock to have breakfast if you're going to do one of the tours.
Oh.
So, and then you've got to be looking at your watch because you've got to be back at 4 o'clock to catch the boat again or ship.
That would drive me nuts.
So
I'd miss
that's
it.
What you're going to be telling Mrs. O'Brien?
Yeah, she'd be fine. I'd be an absolute mess. Actually, I say that she's terrible at airports. So you quite liked that? You liked having the timetabling and the slightly
not at all.
No, you
I
didn't.
Hated
no,
the discipline.
Yeah, no,
I,
exactly.
We spent 20 years, you know, going to our own place we had over in Cyprus, and
that's it. Well, you can do what you want.
Out.
You can do what you want, John. When you're
right,
you
exactly.
know, you know your way around. You got your favourite watering holes. You know where you get the good.
Or just stay in the pool. You know, have a gin and tonic.
Day like
job
that.
Done.
So it is. So who likes that then? Do we think?
Well, I think we might try again because it's one of those all inclusives, and it's it's a different type of person on the all inclusives.
What does that mean? Go on, tell me.
No, carry on cruising. There was a few of the carry on cruisers at the end of the bar.
Oh, okay. Yes. All right. So you've got Kenneth Connor at the end of
that's
the bar
it.
making his way through several sailors' daily allowances.
Yeah. But I would say it's a way of getting a taster because we did Malta. And we did one of the tours, and we like Malta, so we may go back there for a week's holiday.
Yeah, I mean, you're retired, I sense.
Partly.
Yeah, so you've got a lot of time. Yeah. So if you've only got 2 weeks a year, a cruise is it's a bit much bigger risk than it is for someone in your status,
definitely.
In your position.
Yeah.
Okay, so I didn't really go mad for it, but you're going to give it another go.
Potentially. I'm taking another 30 years.
Is there an unregimented equivalent? Is there a cruise company that kind of lets you get...
I don't know.
You couldn't really do your own thing, could you? Because the boat's going to leave.
No, I think we've been told the West Indies is a good one to do the, you know, but we thought we'd do this taste a week first.
Do you have to dress for dinner?
No.
Okay.
No, you can dress smart for different restaurants.
Oh, okay.
We had a good choice.
Yeah, these are the bits where I start warming to it. This is where I like start warming. I tell you what I used to love as a boy, John. I used to love the ferry to France.
Yeah.
It was like a kingdom, and you'd wander around it, and you'd find an observation deck or another bar or the arcade where you could play. Like video game, well, very primitive video games.
Just as a side show, we did one of these sort of out-the-paper mini-cruises to Iceberg about 20, 30 years ago.
Yes.
And when we got there, the fog came in. the lady who was taking us around kept saying, if you could see, this is what you would see. So we had 3 days.
I hope you gave her a good tip.
It's brilliant.
That's an amazing gift.
Seal sanctuary, I think, got frozen seals in it, but that's about it.
Didn't see anything. I mean, she could have just been leading you around the block, couldn't she, by not showing you anything at all, just claiming that the sights that you would have seen had the fog not been there were extraordinary. Such things I have not seen. Thank you, John. I don't even know anymore. Neil's in Haverhill. Neil, what would you like to say?
Hello, James. Good to speak to you.
Likewise, Neil.
Yeah, we went on first cruise ever, my partner and I, back on the last day of January. We went up to see the very, very northernmost top of Norway to see the Northern Lights.
Oh, I could get into that, the Aurora Borealis.
That's it.
Oh.
Yeah, if you've not gone to see them up there, you haven't seen them.
I like
they are terrific.
Okay, that could tempt me, actually.
we went, as I say, first cruise, we went on a Norwegian line. Is it all right if I don't mention them?
Because
they were good. And,
okay.
I can if it's not a problem.
No, I don't know. I mean, why don't we decide when you finish the story?
Okay, man. But we went up to, as I say, we had a 15-day cruise. We got to Southampton and we were told that there was going to be a five-hour delay because there was an outbreak of gastroenteritis on the ship.
So this was, you were coming home at this point?
No, we were just
when you got there. How can they have had an outbreak of gastroenteritis? Oh, like the previous people?
Correct, from the previous cruise.
That's going to put me right off, though.
Well, long story short, we didn't catch it. Although
so it was a deep clean, was it? They were giving the boat a deep clean or something like that?
They did before the cruise began, and they were doing it on and off all the way through. They were washing all over the place, but we did lose several amenities we couldn't have.
For example?
I'll tell you what, it sounds silly, but it was a blooming nuisance, was using the public toilets around the ship. We couldn't do that, so we always had to go all the way back to your cabin.
Did you go over the side then, did you?
No, I did think once, but I thought, no, it's a bit too public.
It's frowned on. You've got a big old boat, and you're off doing your thing. You're at the Knobbly Knees contest, or you're enjoying a lecture, or something like that, and then you can't use the facilities. You've got to go all the way back to your cabin. So the bigger the boat, the bigger the inconvenience, really.
True. Now, we were lucky. The ship wasn't huge. I think nowadays there are bigger car ferries crossing the channel now than we had.
Okay. So you'd do it again?
Definitely.
Okay. I mean, there's a certain consensus emerging on this. I was hoping for stuff a little bit grislier. I'm not going to lie to you, Neil. But, you know, secondhand gastroenteritis isn't necessarily a deal breaker, is it? It's not going to put you off. It's coming up to 12:30. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I've got a peculiar following among cruisers, clearly. Our switchboard's absolutely groaning under the weight of people. I'm looking for some more negative stories now in the interest of balance. But up next, Hetty O'Brien, who has written a book that really addresses so many of the points that we examine. Sometimes it feels a rather lonely business when we examine them on this programme. The tyranny, if you like, of what she has chosen to call the asset class, but which we routinely refer to as private equity, the profits reaped by investors who, as I've said to you on several occasions, whether we're talking about care homes, burger joints or water companies, they don't care about anything except money, and we all labour under the illusion that we do. Some of the consequences of that will be explained to us by Hetty O'Brien, the author of The Asset Class, after the very latest headlines with Amelia Cox.
The Prime Minister says he won't tolerate attempts by Iran to destabilise British society at a summit to tackle anti-Semitism. Leaders from across public life have joined Sir Keir Starmer for talks. Meanwhile, counter-terror police are investigating a suspected arson attack at a former synagogue in East London. Iran has warned the US we're just getting started following a return to hostilities in the Strait of Hormuz. A four-week ceasefire collapsed yesterday after Donald Trump promised the US would begin guiding ships through the strait. And a British crew member is said to have developed symptoms of a rare virus on a cruise ship and is in need of urgent medical care. A passenger from the UK is also in a critical but stable condition in South Africa following an outbreak of hantavirus, which has already killed three people. LBC weather, sunny spells and scattered showers drifting down from the north. Northern Scotland turns cooler with the most frequent showers, a high of 18 degrees.
This is LBC.
Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
At Wix, the Home and Garden event is now on. Save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £24, now £16. Ends Wednesday. Terms apply.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling.
banningdental.co.uk.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature, biotiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful Gut Health. Switch your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and give your gut and your summer a lift. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? A record 9 years running.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Energising a better Britain.
12.33 is the time. The latest in an occasional series when I say to you, here's a book, go and buy it. Etty O'Brien has written a book called The Asset Class, which speaks to so many areas of conversations that we have regularly on the programme, Etty. And I think it's fair to say that anyone who thinks that we exaggerate when we talk about the iniquity of private equity and the potential depth and breadth of the damage that it can do to a society is not exaggerating. But let's begin at the beginning. Why did you decide that you wanted to write this book?
Well, I think I was thinking about a lot of the things that probably a lot of people in Britain are thinking about now, to do with the sense in which the economy feels quite stacked against us or against the general population. And you get a lot of explanations for that can feel quite abstract and remote: cost of living crisis, lack of economic growth. And actually, as a journalist, when I was looking into subjects to do with housing, water, and so on, this same group of companies with names that I hadn't even really heard of before kept cropping up. And these are private equity firms. It just seemed that after 2008, they'd gone on this gigantic shopping spree, buying up the places where we live and work and die, and perfecting this really cradle-to-grave model of investment that was having all sorts of effects on the ways we live now. And as you said previously, it's a really lonely business. This isn't an industry that wants people to really see inside it, and it doesn't want to tell us much about what it's up to. And so as a journalist, when you get the sense that something is really powerful but also wants to kind of go under the radar, you think, I want to get inside that black box.
Well, but that's the beauty of the book, because we have all encountered sort of sprouts emerging from the black box, and everyone will have favourites, whether it's, you know, the water company is probably the most obvious, certainly in mainstream news coverage and in recent years. But I have personal experience of a residential children's home shutting down for reasons that none of us could understand until it emerged that it was owned by private equity. People's favourite restaurants suddenly becoming considerably less enjoyable than they used to be because private equity has moved in and decided to shave a bit off here and shave a bit off there. The bit that is probably hardest to convey to somebody listening to this who has only scratched the very surface of it is that none of that matters. The overarching ambition is just more money. So it doesn't matter whether it's an autistic child, a beef burger, or a water company. They just see an entity that can be further squeezed.
Yeah, I think that the results or the consequences, though, are really catastrophic when it comes to the services that we rely upon in our everyday lives. If you think about the money you have coming into your bank account each month and then what goes out, the bills that you're spending on that you have no choice over whether or not you pay for, water, the place where you live, energy, and so on. That's the areas where this is a really ill-suited model, I think.
Because if it's owned by the state, then the state has a vested interest in keeping everything up and running. If it's owned by private equity, then infrastructure is actually antithetical to short-term profit.
Well, yeah, and I think when you look at the type of model of investment this involves, it involves basically loading assets and companies that private equity funds acquire with debt in order to enrich those private equity fund managers and some of their investors. That is fundamentally ill-suited to public services. And when you look at what has happened in care, for example, at care homes that were taken over in the US by private equity funds, before and after those takeovers. After those takeovers, death rates increased by something like 11% because of the effects of that debt. Because what that debt does is it means that a company has less money to spend on doing the very thing that it's supposed to be doing, whether that's cooking you a burger or caring for your elderly relative. And it's when it's caring for your elderly relative that I think it becomes really catastrophic.
Where do we sit on this as a country? Where does the United Kingdom? Because I thought we had a particular problem. We don't, do we? This is obviously a global issue. A hospital in Africa that features in your book that is a particularly hideous story. And you mentioned the United States care homes. Do we have? I mean, are we? Some of the companies have British connections, but the UK isn't a particular victim of this.
Well, I disagree. I actually think that we have our governments and our ministers have had a decades-long love affair with private equity.
Why did it start in 2008? Sorry to interrupt.
Well, it started actually a bit before that. It started really in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and it comes out of the US. And what you get when it comes to Britain is this realisation that actually this investment model of heaping debt upon assets and companies is really well-suited to what's going on in Britain, where you've got the creation of all these new opportunities because formerly publicly owned companies such as the water companies or such as care homes are being privatized. And so I came across a fund manager who was in the US who wrote a really interesting book on infrastructure, who said Britain really is the leading model for this in terms of where this experiment plays out. We're really at the sharp end of this. It might be an American model, but it's definitely traveled to Britain and it's had really big consequences here.
So I borrow a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
I buy a formerly state-owned asset and I then dedicate myself to taking as much money as I humanly can out of that state-owned asset until the pipsqueak.
Well, look at the fact that we're paying, 28% of our water bills in England and Wales now go on servicing debt that were taken on in order to enrich investors and fund managers. So yeah.
I can find an enraged person literally within moments of giving out the phone number if we were talking about a football club where exactly the same model had been deployed. But it would be a little bit harder to find an enraged person sufficiently well informed to understand that this is what has happened to their grandma's care home or their own water supplier.
Mm.
Why is that?
Well, I think that's a real shame, and that's what I was hoping to do with the book, was really shed a light on that and show people how it really affects their everyday lives. But I think partly opacity and power go together. The industry is very secretive, and there's a form of power in that, in the sense that in not having to tell people what it's up to, it means that it can't be properly held accountable.
And when we hear about the bonfires of red tape and deregulation and things like that, they're often euphemisms to describe making life easier for the sort of vested interests that you're examining here.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at the lobbying for the greatest tax break that's perhaps ever been achieved within the history of the British state, which is the carried interest loophole. Might sound technical. What it means is that private equity fund managers pay less tax on their incomes than you or I pay. And that's actually a result of a really concerted lobbying effort to do with the idea that this model would bring quote-unquote investment to the country. But when you look at what investment means, it means very different things to different people.
This is the sort of the latest iteration of the trickle-down myth, really, isn't it? It's the idea that if you provide impunity or more freedom to create epic amounts of money, somehow everyone will benefit.
It's a trickle-down myth updated for an age of austerity, where you have this argument that public spending cannot be afforded and therefore private capital has to be relied upon to fill the holes created by the retreat of the state.
And yet somehow there'll be more money to care for the public responsibilities while private interests are taking more money out of the system anyway. So, I mean, it's like it's like Percy in Blackadder coming up with a brooch of purest green. It's like, it's obviously not going to work.
And we obviously end up paying for it. It's just we pay for it perhaps later or in ways that are less visible.
Meanwhile, it's trebles all round in the boardrooms of the companies that you examine here.
The industry has been referred to as a billionaire machine for a very good reason, which is that the profits and the benefits of its methods largely flow to and are captured by a small group of financial insiders.
Do you have a... This is going to sound like a bit of a crass question, but do you have a favourite? I mean, is it the water company? Is there one area where the iniquities of this practice and this system are more glaring or more obnoxious than they are in all the other areas?
I would say none of these areas are my favourites.
What I mean.
Look, I think that when it came to care, perhaps it's because I have more of a vested interest in this personally. Perhaps it's because I think it's where things happen to people in care homes behind closed doors, because those people are vulnerable, because they are often elderly, as you mentioned, your relative who's autistic, people who cannot stand up for themselves. And in a context where other forms of regulation and investigation and other watchdogs have exited the picture, when you have private equity investors moving into those spheres, I think that's really where the dangers occur.
And there is no sphere safe. I mean, if those areas can be subject to this practice, then any area can be.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at what's happened to vet surgeries, which is not necessarily an area that you'd think would be particularly exciting for Wall Street financiers, private equity now owns, I think it's around 60% of vet surgeries.
Undertakers were an even earlier example, weren't
Undertakers, they? Exactly. Yeah. Your funeral parlour is quite possibly owned by private equity, and you don't even realise that to be the case.
Is there a route back?
I think the route back is, particularly when it comes to my concern, is what this looks like within public services, within the things that we depend upon. The route back looks like having greater confidence behind the idea of public investment, because public investment does attract private investment. When the government spends money, private capital will follow, but we cannot rely upon that capital to do the work that government should be doing, because actually that conditions the very things we end up with as a society. We hear a lot about the need for rebuilding Britain, for infrastructure, and when you look at the types of infrastructure that this industry is creating, Keir Starmer announcing on LinkedIn that Blackstone is building a data centre, is that data centre going to have beneficial effects for people in Britain in the way that fixing all the potholes would? No, but it will make somebody somewhere exceedingly wealthy.
Are they, I mean, this might be a bit too speculative, but are they a little bit gaslit political figures? There's so much effort put into wooing them and courting them, and there's not that much challenge to the overarching narrative that this is both necessary and desirable.
There isn't much challenge. That's a challenge that I was hoping to pose with the book. But also there is the time-worn story of lobbying, of vested financial interests, of private equity, the private equity industry and its lobbying body in the UK, giving money to various politicians and so on. And I think that's
just to be clear, this is money that is given to politicians not secretly. You're not alluding to £5 million donations made secretly to politicians.
There's no laws being broken here whatsoever, but doesn't that tell you something about our existing laws?
Indeed it does. It tells me lots of things that the whole book does. Hetty O'Brien's The Asset Class: How Private Equity Turned Capitalism Against Itself is out now. Thank you, Hetty. Would you like to hear what Stuart had to say on the subject of your visit to the studio?
Yeah.
He says, that's two brilliant O'Briens that I've heard on LBC now. Phillips O'Brien at St Andrews University and Hetty O'Brien, the author of The Asset Class.
That's very kind.
Yeah, very good, Stuart. Well done. It's 12:46.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
US Defence Secretary Pete Hegseth is live shortly as the US and Iran slug it out. Is the Prime Minister too toxic for the election campaign trail? And how did anti-Semitism infect our public bodies?
Sheila Fogarty. At 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
At John Lewis Money, we know your home is more than an address. It's the sunlight pouring in. Well, sometimes. The coffee on tap and the best spot on the sofa. It's why our home insurance is thoughtfully designed with 3 levels of flexible cover for the home you've created. Because when you notice the details, you notice the difference. Search John Lewis Money. Terms and exclusions apply. John Lewis Finance Limited is authorised for insurance distribution and credit broking by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Noticed a change in your hearing? Well, get a hearing check from Specsavers. Oh, not sure where to start? Well, we're very flexible. Book one online, on the phone, on your lunch break, on Saturdays, on the same day if you're lucky. Oh, you only miss the odd word. But what if the odd words you're missing are nice ones like love you, or important ones like duck? Oh, too expensive, is it? All right, we like you. We'll do it for nothing. For free hearing checks, should have gone to Specsavers.
Shine Night Walk London is a 10K, half marathon or full marathon supported walk around the city at night on the 19th of September to raise vital money for Cancer Research UK. It's also
everyone walking with all their colours, twinkling away.
We can actually see how nice London is. And London is different at night time.
Celebration of life, and it gives hope.
Step towards a brighter future at shinewalk.org today to get 30% off your entry. Together, we are beating cancer. T's and C's apply.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. All wobbly, all wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxing.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby.
Download the Thameslink Railway app to book advanced single tickets from London St Pancras to Cambridge from only £11. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply.
Now with Lidl Plus, collect points that you can turn into possibilities.
Pepper abilities.
Ooh.
Pasta abilities.
Burrata abilities.
Kayak abilities.
So collect and spend your Lidl Plus points on hundreds of rewards or money off coupons. Lidl, more to value. Exclusions apply. For T's and C's, lidl.co.uk/LPTV 18 plus GB only.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
12:48 is the time, and just for the avoidance of doubt, Hetty O'Brien, the author of The Asset Class, is not, to the best of both our knowledge, any relation of mine. Natasha Clark is back from her travels. Keir Starmer has been, leading a sort of summit on anti-Semitism. What have we learnt?
Yes, so he's just been hosting a roundtable of leaders from basically across society this morning, James, in Number 10. So leaders from the Jewish groups, from community groups, from the police, politicians, essentially to talk to them about what more we can do to tackle anti-Semitism. He says he wants a, quote, whole society approach to this problem. And of course, it all comes after the spate of attacks we've seen in recent weeks on the Jewish community, the most recent being the Golders Green attack last week, the arson attacks on Jewish ambulances, the Heaton Park synagogue attack as well a few months ago. Starmer has today announced an extra £1.5 million in funding to strengthen community cohesion and to protect Jews in areas where they face, quote, the greatest risk. Ministers also are planning anti-terror laws that will enable them to ban the IRGC. That's going to come in the next parliamentary session, we understand.
That was already in the pipeline, I think.
It was, yeah, indeed. And like I say, it has taken them a little while to get to grips with this, I think, James, and many people in the Jewish community just feel that the Prime Minister hasn't been acting quickly enough. They want to hear more than just warm words from him. We know that he was heckled a little bit on a visit to Golders Green last week.
So was the head of the Met.
Exactly. So it's a problem that obviously many Jewish people feel very strongly about, understandably, and are wanting more action on this. But it is also important to recognise Keir Starmer, of course, in a very unique position on anti-Semitism. He inherited the Labour Party, who was accused of having a huge problem on this at the time. So speaking earlier today in Downing Street, he said that he had seen that poison of anti-Semitism growing within the Labour Party, and now greater action is needed to be taken in the country.
Because only by working together can we eradicate anti-Semitism from every corner of society. I've seen this poison up close. I've seen the damage it does when it takes hold, and I know what it demands to root it out. A coordinated approach, an unwavering resolve, and zero tolerance for failure. That is the action I took in the Labour Party, that I had to take in the Labour Party. And that is what we must do today.
And James, he also announced today that universities are going to have to step up and say more about what they are doing to tackle anti-Semitism on campus.
When abuses take place, we're calling on universities to demonstrate action. We will now expect them to publish the scale of the problem on their campuses, as well as the specific steps they have taken to clamp down on it. There will be zero tolerance for inaction. In our cultural venues and spaces, we will also expect more. Where public funding is being used to promote or platform anti-Semitism, the Arts Council must act, using its powers to suspend, withdraw, and claw back funding. And today we're mandating an independent audit of how allegations are handled.
So I thought what was interesting from that, James, is obviously, you know, Jewish groups obviously experiencing demands for funding day in, day out, and they need that extra security in order to continue. Basically saying to bodies, government groups, which are funding these arts organisations, and saying, look, you know, this needs to be funded by government. They obviously face increased risks. And he doesn't want Jewish groups, comedians, artists, to be squashed out of public life purely because they have to pay for police on the door, for extra security, for more people to make sure that these events can go ahead. And also the idea of taking away funding from groups which are funded by the government if they do not do enough to stamp out anti-Semitism. We know that, of course, this has been a problem amongst students on campuses, and also, you know, what the government could do in terms of banning some potential protests. So there's a lot of things I think the government are looking at. It isn't quite clear whether they will be taking more action on protests imminently. We talked as well just then about the idea of banning the RGC. It's not quite clear why it's taken the Home Office and the government quite so long to get around to doing that, but there are clearly national security implications that people within government are keeping at the forefront of their mind, especially with what's going on in Iran and the wider Middle East conflict.
Big difference, isn't there, between cleaning out a political party and cleaning out a country.
Of course, but equally, there's lots of lessons I'm sure he can draw on. And also, you know, at the time it was said, you know, this can't really be done because it's something that sort of roots itself in society. And actually, Sir Mark Rowley, the head of the Metropolitan Police, has been calling for this sort of wider approach to this problem for a long time. So Keir Starmer has decided to take him up on this idea of a summit, which it's not just politics, it's not just Met Police, it's people from across society saying this is what we think and what do you think the government could do more to tackle this problem.
But raising his own children in the Jewish faith, I think.
Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
Yes, I believe so. I believe that he sort of wouldn't class himself as sort of traditionally practicing, and it's his wife Victoria that has spoken about this a little bit in the past.
And this is why he said he wouldn't work on Friday evenings unless he absolutely had to.
Exactly.
Because they're observing Challah and Kiddush, I think.
Yes, I think you're right. That was something that he'd said before the election and got quite a lot of criticism for it. And Keir Starmer doesn't talk about this. He doesn't talk about the fact that it is something that affects his own family very often at
why
all.
Why not?
It's interesting. I don't know, actually. I think probably just
think
because
of some politicians he would. Good or for ill. I mean, he's never opportunistic.
I think that's it. I think he doesn't want to be seen as I'm a part of this community, therefore I'm against this other part of this community. He wants to be seen as a prime minister, like most people do, for everyone, right? But there are lots of things I think the government are accused of not doing enough on. These protests are one of them. It's a really difficult balance, and I heard from politicians all across the political spectrum over the last sort of few days about how they feel about taking more action on police and protesting. But equally, you speak to Jewish community groups and they say, well, we're seeing a direct correlation between the protests on our streets and what is now happening in terms of very targeted attacks on the Jewish community. So they are calling for more action to be taken. And it does sound like the government are listening on that. And Keir Starmer sort of indicated over the weekend that will be the cumulative effect of some of these protests will be taken into account.
Protests against what is going on in Gaza, or was going on in Gaza, and what continues to go on in Lebanon.
Yes, exactly. So and I don't think it is that the government have a problem with. Of course they don't. What they do have a problem with is when it turns into extreme language, when it turns into calls, which I shan't repeat, which some people say is giving oxygen to these attacks and giving legitimacy to this. But what I think is really interesting about this approach from the government today is exactly the idea that anti-Semitism, that racism lives sort of in not just in one corner of society. It is something very embedded, very ingrained in some communities, and that the government are looking at a wider approach rather than just saying we're just going to give more money to security services.
Indeedy. Natasha Clark, thank you very much indeed. I mean, words today, more words, which of course many members of the Jewish community have suggested are not enough, but perhaps words that will on this occasion lead to action. I mean, a quick heads up on what some of the issues that Keir Starmer was alluding to. The fact that the Golders Green attacks last week, the suspect also believed to have attacked someone he'd known for 20 years in Southwark previously. I saw some extraordinary attempts on social media this weekend to sort of claim that it challenged the notion that the Golders Green attacks had been anti-Semitic, that the fact that an earlier victim had clearly not been Jewish. And those are the sort of things that reminded me of some of the characters and some of the arguments that Keir Starmer had to deal with when he actually inherited the mantle of leadership of the Labour Party. But even being quite familiar with the practice didn't stop it from being absolutely shocking and quite mind-boggling, actually. at times. Natasha, thank you very much indeed. I think we're out of time, but Diane in Whitstable has been waiting for ages. Why would you want to go on a cruise if you already live in Whitstable?
Well, I've only recently moved to Whitstable, actually. But, yeah, I was a reluctant cruiser. My husband always wanted to go. And in the end, in the spirit of harmony, I sort of gave in and said, OK, let's go. And we ended up cruising. We've done a few cruises now, but two fantastic places. One, we cruised to the Baltics, and we managed to spend 2 days in St. Petersburg, where we saw all of the sights, and it was just amazing. And I know that people are not probably going to be able to go there, certainly in the near future, if ever. So that was amazing to be able to do that. And the other one was my love of Norway, and I've cruised to the Arctic Circle twice now, and I would never have seen Norway in the way that I saw it if it hadn't been some cruises. And I just want to say, you don't get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go on trips. We're quite late risers. We've had fantastic days out, which have encouraged us then to go to other countries. I mean, we've done other holidays. It's not just been cruising.
But
to go
sold.
Back to see, pardon?
Sold on the cruising now.
Do it.
I can't go on my own.
I bet you'll love it.
I can't go on my own, can I? And I don't think I'm ever going to be able to tempt Mrs. O'Brien. I'll keep trying. How long did your husband badger you for before you finally gave in?
Probably about 15 years, I will be honest.
Right.
And there became a point where, and I just to say, our son at the time we went was 15, and it will be one of his best holidays because of there were young adults, and he managed to meet quite a lot of people, where on some of the traditional holidays we'd been on.
Oh, it's a bit late for me now.
Only child.
My kids are older than yours, so, hey, I'll tell you what, that ship has sailed for me, Diane.
Oh, it's okay, he's 24 now, so I am looking back, but yeah.
Diane, I said that ship has sailed.
Oh, sorry.
Flipping heck.
Woman misses terrible dad jokes.
It wasn't a terrible dad joke. I do apologise, Diane, thank you. I enjoyed that conversation. I don't know if I'm any warmer or cooler towards the idea of cruising, but best wishes and commiserations to all of the people caught up in the latest crisis. If you missed any of the show today, you can listen back on Global Player. It's free, as is the LBC app. You can listen to a range of podcasts, including mine. You can download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Stay tuned for Tom Swarbrick at 4. But first, don't you touch that dial. It's Sheila Fogarty.
Absolutely not. Thanks very much indeed, James. At 3 today, the Prime Minister warns public bodies from the NHS and universities to the Arts Council and trade unions to stop turning a blind eye to anti-Semitism in their ranks. About time, too. Mr. Starmer, the question is, how do we rid ourselves of anti-Semitism? What do we do in the face of it in said public bodies? To Keir Starmer, not much of a presence in the local and devolved election campaign so far. The clock's ticking. Is he too toxic for the voters? Is that why? Are they hiding him away a bit? Will he, whatever happens on Thursday, Friday overnight, will he be too toxic for the electorate after that as well? The US Defence Secretary, Pete Hegseth, is live shortly. We'll take it live as the US and Iran continue to sort of slug it out on the Strait of Hormuz.
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
Clock. Sir Keir Starmer has warned Iran he won't tolerate efforts to stir up violence and hatred in the UK. The Prime Minister has been holding a summit to tackle anti-Semitism, inviting community groups, senior ministers and police chiefs. He insists there will be consequences if Tehran is found to be behind a series of recent attacks. But Mark Levy from the Jewish Leadership Council has told LBC the issue has been building for a while.
It's the realisation that the UK is not going to be as kind to my children as it has been to me and my family for many generations now. This is not just a Jewish communal problem. This is a British problem because anti-Semitism is often described as the canary in the coal mine. It is the first sign in society that there is a sickness, and what starts with Jewish people does not end with Jewish people.
As talks were being held in Downing Street, it emerged counter-terror police were investigating a suspected arson at a former synagogue. Fire crews were called to the building in Tower Hamlets in East London this morning. No injuries have been reported. The Speaker of the Iranian Parliament has warned the US we are just getting started after hostilities returned to the Strait of Hormuz yesterday. It followed a promise by Donald Trump to begin guiding ships through the strait. Travelodge has apologised after a man was given a key to the room of a woman he was harassing. The case in York last year is the latest to be revealed following a series of reported security lapses at the hotel chain. Speaking exclusively to LBC, Lucy, which isn't her real name, says no checks were carried out by staff.
I obviously felt like I could have been sexually assaulted because there was a man telling me he was sexually attracted to me. He went with intention, got a room key and entered my room.
Travelodge says it has made changes to its checking procedures. And Dolly Parton has cancelled her Las Vegas residency months after postponing a number of other gigs due to health concerns. The 80-year-old was due to begin a 6-date run at the Coliseum at Caesar's Palace in September. She says her immune and digestive systems are out of whack. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 131 points at 10,232. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, sunny spells and scattered showers drifting down from the north. Northern Scotland turns cooler with the most frequent showers, a high of 18 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello, good afternoon to you. Let's go straight to the Pentagon, where U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is speaking.
And temporary in duration, with one mission, protecting innocent commercial shipping from Iranian aggression. American forces won't need to enter Iranian waters or airspace. It's not necessary. We're not looking for a fight, but Iran also cannot be allowed to block innocent countries and their goods from an international waterway. Iran is the clear aggressor, harassing civilian vessels, threatening mariners from every nation indiscriminately, and weaponizing a critical choke point for its own financial benefit, or at least trying to. For too long, Iran has been harassing ships, shooting at civilian tankers from all nations, and trying to impose a tolling system. Iran's plan, a form of international extortion, is unacceptable. That ends with Project Freedom. Two U.S. commercial ships, along with American destroyers, have already safely transited the strait, showing the lane is clear. We know the Iranians are embarrassed by this fact. They said they control the strait. They do not. So American ships led the way, commercial and military, shouldering the initial risk from the front, as Americans always do. And right now, hundreds more ships from nations around the world are lining up to transit. CENTCOM, along with partner nations, is in active communication with hundreds of ships, shipping companies, and insurers. All of these ships from all around the world want to get out of the Iranian trap that they have been stuck inside. As a direct gift from the United States to the world, we have established a powerful red, white, and blue dome over the strait. American destroyers are on station, supported by hundreds of fighter jets, helicopters, drones, and surveillance aircraft, providing 24/7 overwatch for peaceful commercial vessels. Except Iran's, of course, which is why our ironclad blockade remains in full effect as well. In fact, six ships tried to run the blockade out of Iranian ports as Project Freedom commenced, and they were all turned around. This is more than strategy. It's also humanitarian. By breaking Iran's illegal stranglehold, we're protecting the lives and livelihoods of sailors from dozens of countries, securing global energy routes, and preventing shortages that hit the world's poorest people the hardest. Once again, America is using its strength to lift up others. Iran is trying to subjugate the world. To what remains of Iran's forces, if you attack American troops or innocent commercial shipping, you will face overwhelming and devastating American firepower. The president has been very clear about this. We prefer this to be a peaceful operation, but are locked and loaded to defend our people, our ships, our aircraft, and this mission without hesitation. To Iran, let innocent ships pass freely. These international waters belong to all nations, not to Iran to tax, toll, or control. To our partners, allies, and the rest of the world, this is a temporary mission for us. As I've said before, the world needs this waterway a lot more than we do. We're stabilizing the situation so commerce can flow again, but we expect the world to step up. At the appropriate time and soon, we will hand responsibility back to you. To the incredible Americans executing this mission right now, simply thank you. Your courage, your readiness, your unmatched professionalism and precision are why the world can breathe easier today and every day. You are and always will be the greatest fighting force in human history, unmatched always. Project Freedom is underway. Commerce will be flowing, and America is once again leading with strength, clarity, and purpose for the benefit of the entire world. Our will is unshakable. God bless our troops, and God bless the mighty United States Navy as well. Mr. Chairman, over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here. On Sunday, at the direction of the President, CENTCOM initiated Project Freedom with the objective of facilitating the safe passage of international commercial shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. Over the past 7 weeks, Iran's repeatedly threatened and attacked commercial shipping in the Strait in order to effectively cut off commercial traffic and damage the global economy. By obstructing one of the world's most critical maritime checkpoints, a vital transit route for approximately one-fifth of the global oil consumption, Iran is weaponizing the global supply chain. This action disregards established navigational rights and the law of the sea, and the regime led by the IRGC is effectively attempting to hold the entire global economy hostage. Let me give you an update of the last few days of activities, and if you take a look at the map here, as the Secretary said, the United States has established Project Freedom to open up the Strait of Hormuz. This graphic highlights the kinetic engagements that the Iranians have attempted to make or have taken against the region. The green dots and blue dots show the groupings of commercial cargo and tanker vessels, and the United States has